good Tuesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you've joined us today on this Super Tuesday. John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show, is going to join us a little bit later on in the hour. We're going to talk about the death of a Virginia police officer who is being laid to rest today. A sheriff's deputy who was shot 8 times the other night and survived. As a matter of fact, see a lot of clickbait headlines, 7 amazing things, right? Well, this was the headline. The sheriff's deputy was shot 8 times last night. Her post this morning is amazing. It actually really was amazing. And we'll talk with John. John's going to be with us Thursday of this week at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, which is good because we might need some muscle of our own there at CPAC this year. I keep saying it's going to be like the Jets and the Sharks, or maybe the rival news teams in the Anchorman movies just beefing out. I have no idea what's going to happen at CPAC, but I think it's going to be very, very interesting. Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition is going to join us. By the way, we'll be at CPAC Thursday and Friday of this week. So seriously, if you're going to be there, stop by, say hello. Lars Dealside, NRA ILA Media Liaison, coming up next hour on the reciprocity bill signed by Governor Terry McAuliffe. We talked with Delegate Michael Webert about the legislation yesterday, and we'll talk with Lars about it coming up in about an hour from now. Congressman Blaine Lukemire of Missouri with the latest on Operation Choke Point. You know, we talked with Kelsey Harkness of the Daily Signal about this not long ago. She ran into or ran across a couple of individuals who work in the firearms industry in Ohio, about 30 miles from each other. I don't think that they were aware of each other's presence. I don't think they were aware that each other were trying to secure loans through financial institutions that they had done business with in the past. But both these individuals ended up having trouble because of the industry in which they work. Why is this happening? Why is this continuing to happen when the Obama administration has said, listen, we were never targeting the firearms industry in the first place. The FDIC pulled down its guidance, warning lenders, hey, listen, these are high-risk industries. When you do business with someone in these high-risk industries, you're just opening yourself up to more risk of an audit, for instance. They took down that advisory. Why are we still seeing stories like this? Again, we'll talk about it with Congressman Blaine Lukemire of Missouri. Gabby Hoffman of Counterculture next hour. Writing in the Washington Times, says disabled gun owners should not be disarmed. I didn't even realize that this was a thing. I take that back. Because I recall over the years, and by the way, 12 years ago today, it was my first day on the job at NRA News, Cam and Company. Our first show, April 16th. So we still have a few weeks before our anniversary, our show anniversary. But it's been 12 years. And I recall over those 12 years that we have had stories where you have seen legislation introduced that not again, you don't see lawmakers saying we're going to make it harder for disabled people to keep and bear arms. But that is the net result of the legislation. So we'll talk with Gabby Hoffman about it next hour. Brian Lilly from the Rebel in Canada and the Blaze here in the United States on the long gun registry that the province of Quebec has been calling for ever since the federal Canadian long gun registry went away. And now, as the process to start that long gun registry in Quebec tries to move forward, all of a sudden this opposition is showing up, real opposition. And Quebec has always been one of those places where it seemed like there really wasn't a pro-gun voice among lawmakers and legislators. And yet, we are seeing, again, a surprising show of strength in opposition to this long gun registry. Doesn't necessarily mean we're going to see a full-fledged turnaround there in the province of Quebec, but it is interesting to see. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media joining us in Hour 3 as well, talking about Super Tuesday, some of the other news of the day, but a lot of Super Tuesday news to talk about. Hopefully, if you are in one of the states that's voting today, you have had the opportunity to get out and head to the polls. If not yet, well, if you're listening to us on SiriusXM Patriot, sorry, I think the polls have closed. But if you are able to tune in live on NRAnews.com, still have a few hours to get out there. And again, it looks like turnout is going to be high in many of these states here. I was the 10th person to vote in my precinct in rural Virginia. That was at about 8 o'clock in the morning. Kyle Morgan, who is our technical director down here in the Farmville studio, voted around lunchtime. Precinct totals were, I guess it was like about a 30 to 40 vote lead. Republicans ballot, Republican ballots over Democratic ballots. Now, Prince Edward County in Virginia is about a 50-50 split. It's pretty close to as purple as you can get. And again, right now, at least in the midday exit polling in one location in central Virginia, it looks like turnout is higher among Republicans. This has been the case in all four states that have held their primaries or their caucuses to date. Not only have you had turnout higher for Republicans in all four states compared to 2012, which was the last time we had a contested primary, but over on the Democratic side, all four states have seen a drop-off in turnout compared to 2008, which was the last time that Democrats had a contested primary. So the states that are up for grabs: Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Georgia, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, and Virginia. Texas, the a big delegate state, 155 delegates up for grabs in Texas tonight, 76 in Georgia. And then you've got 49 in Virginia, 50 Alabama, 42 in Massachusetts, 40 in Arkansas, 58 Tennessee, 43 in Oklahoma. But again, it'll be interesting to see the turnout in these states, particularly states like Massachusetts, for instance, which, you know, we think of Massachusetts as a pretty deep blue state, but in actuality, Massachusetts is one of those states where independents far outnumber the number of registered Democrats and Republicans. So where do those voters go today? Do they go to the Democratic primary? Do they go to the Republican primary? Do they stay at home? We again have seen evidence of a enthusiasm gap throughout the early contests. But today, with all of these states up for grabs, you really start to get an idea of how big and meaningful that intensity gap might be at this early date. Now, over on the Democratic side, it looks like Hillary Clinton is poised to win most of the states that are holding Super Tuesday primaries today. The exceptions might be Massachusetts, where there are 116 delegates up for grabs. Vermont, Bernie Sanders, you know, home state, 26 delegates there. And also Democrats abroad are voting between now and March 8th in their global primary. Huh. I think you still have to be an American citizen eligible to vote in that. Meanwhile, ABC News reporting that the odds of Michael Bloomberg running for president are, quote, very, very low, almost zero, several weeks after this trial balloon was first floated, predicated on the idea that if it turned out to be a Trump versus Sanders race, that Michael Bloomberg could step in, portray himself to be the technocratic centrist who just wants to guide America into a future full of tiny little sodas and single shot firearms, well, potato guns, maybe marshmallow blasters, turn down your iPod because it's way too loud. And yeah. Now, again, the odds that Bernie Sanders will be the candidate are looking less and less likely. And ABC News quotes a Bloomberg confidant as saying, "We are at crunch time." Now, the source for ABC News says that the decision will likely come this week or next. That was likely to be the case regardless, because we are getting to crunch time. If you're running as an independent, you know, you don't have to worry about conventions or primaries, but you do have to worry about getting on the ballot. And the 50 states all have different ballot requirements. And the clock starts basically now. Around March 1st is when you've got the window of opportunity to start gathering signatures to be on the ballot in any given state. So any independent candidate really has maybe a two-week window here if they are realistically going to launch a campaign. It would be, you'd see it happen, I think, well before April 1st. I think March 15th would be even cutting it a little close. But you could maybe start around March 15th. But the next few weeks are going to be really telling, not just for Michael Bloomberg, but for anybody else who is thinking about getting into the race. ABC News is back in January. They were told that the odds of Michael Bloomberg running were 50-50. If it looked like Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee and Bernie Sanders would be the Democratic nominee, with Hillary Clinton looking more and more like the presumptive Democratic nominee, the odds of Bloomberg running have dropped dramatically. ABC News says in his conversations with his closest advisors, Bloomberg has not ruled out beginning the process of getting on the ballot and then deferring a decision until later. Like, all right, we're going to start gathering the signatures, but not necessarily saying I'm going to run here. I'm just gathering the signatures, whatever. Sources told ABC News, though, that Bloomberg is leaning against such a move and is more likely to make a final decision over the next week or two. Well, here's the thing, and you know this. No matter if Michael Bloomberg is running for president or not, we do know that Michael Bloomberg plans on playing an outsized role in this year's elections, right? It was his ability to spend $1 billion, maybe two, on a presidential run that even made this line of thinking possible. I don't know what kind of money Michael Bloomberg is planning on dropping in the elections this year. Let's say it's going to be less than $1 billion. Easily could be northwards of $100 million in elections across the country, not just for the presidential election. Heck, who knows? He might be putting himself in the running for Hillary Clinton's vice presidential nomination. Never know. But I think it's not a bold political prediction to think that Michael Bloomberg is still going to want to have an influence in the elections this year, even if he is not a candidate for office. So that is a good way to segue into a gentle reminder that you too can be involved this election year. You don't have to have $1 billion at your disposal. You just have to have the energy and the passion, and you need to be able to carve out some time. But you can make a difference. You can have an impact no matter where you live. There is a race that you can have a role in shaping. And the best way to do that, I think, is to go to NRAILA.org, click the grassroots tab, find out who your local election volunteer coordinator is, and start getting involved. I mean, it really is that simple. There are some NRA members out there around the country who this year, it'll be like a second full-time job for them. They'll be working 40, 50, 60 hours a week. Not everybody can do that. God bless them for doing it. But even they would tell you, listen, if you can do 2 hours a week, 4 hours a week, whatever, do what you can to make a difference this election season. No matter where you live, again, there are going to be races where you can have an impact. So just a gentle reminder, I'll be doing this periodically throughout the election process, that you can get involved. And the best way to start, again, I think, is through the grassroots division of NRA's Institute for Legislative Action. All right, why don't we take a quick time out? John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show, will join us on the program. There is a lot to talk about in the world of law enforcement, so stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Jim Sapieca, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, in this installment, we want to talk about the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum. Tell us what it's all about.
Well, that is the newest of our three museums. We have the NRA National Firearms Museum here at NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. The NRA National Sporting Arms Museum was opened 2 years ago at the Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri, and it is a spectacular museum. There are about 1,000 historic arms there, and of course, as you'd guess, there's an emphasis on sporting arms, the arms of hunting, of sport shooting. But it goes far, far beyond that. We have exhibits that include guns of the Old West. We've got some great new guns that are just coming in and will be on display soon. Bat Masterson, Bass Reeves, who is a very iconic Old West figure. The first African-American U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi, and one of the most prolific lawmen of the Old West in terms of number of arrests, number of gunfights, a remarkable Old West figure that has been mostly overlooked until just the past few years. That museum, the really gratifying thing about that museum is the attendance. We just hit a milestone, opened 2 years and 2 months, and we have had 700,000 people through that museum. And it's almost 1,000 a day, yeah. Oh. And the demographics there, we get a lot of families, a lot of, mom, dad, and the kids coming through. Right. And it's just great. And you see the parents pointing out the different things to the kids, and then the kids taking them by the hand and saying, come over here and see this.
How do we get more info about that museum?
That museum, all the NRA museums are at the website, nramuseums.com, or you can go visit the museum in Springfield, Missouri at the Bass Pro headquarters shop there. It's open every day of the year except Christmas, and admission is always free at all three of the NRA museums.
What kind of government cares more about appeasing Islamic terrorists than defending the constitutional rights of its citizens? A government that would disarm us during the age of terror. Nothing would make us more vulnerable to generations of suffering and slaughter than the destruction of our Second Amendment. But many of our politicians, aided by a relentless media, are launching that attack themselves. They dream of joining the rest of the disarmed peoples of the world, entrusting our survival to the mercy of monsters. The greatest damage the terrorists could ever inflict upon us is disarmament at the hands of the political elites. But we will never offer our right to survive as a fool's ransom to the world's killers. Our freedom is what they fear most. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I know you're watching, so pay attention. You hate my freedom, my religion, and my country. You hate me for speaking my mind. You try to control me with violence and intimidation. You think you can muzzle me with fear? Don't ever confuse me for my politicians or my media. I am an American, free-born and free-bred, and I will call you out for who you are, an Islamic extremist who would kill me for my beliefs. You don't intimidate me. My freedom is more powerful than anything you can possibly do, and I will never, never surrender my rights to your terror. I will say what I think, worship according to my beliefs, and raise my children how I see fit, and I defend it all with the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. I cower to no one. Because I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
It's your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It is NRA News Cam and Company coming to you once again from beautiful Farmville, Virginia. We'll be up at the mothership tomorrow, be at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, on Thursday and Friday of this week. Looking forward to our broadcast there. John Cardillo is actually going to be sitting in with us for a little bit at CPAC coming up on Thursday. He'll be joining us here in just a couple of minutes. Now, in Woodbridge, Virginia, not too far from where the Conservative Political Action Conference will be held, they're laying to rest Ashley Gindin today. Funeral began about noon Eastern time. The 28-year-old Prince William County police officer killed in the line of duty on her very first shift there as a Prince William County officer on Saturday. And the turnout there in Woodbridge has been absolutely massive as a community pays its respects for Ashley Gindin. John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show, is with us on the program now. John, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am good. I appreciate you joining us on the program. We were just talking about the funeral for Officer Ashley Gindin in Woodbridge, Virginia. This has been a pretty rough stretch of a few days here for law enforcement around the country.
Yeah, absolutely tragic. I mean, and what an exceptional woman, right? She wasn't just a police officer. She was a Marine from a family of police officers. The outpouring of support from the law enforcement community has been overwhelming. There's a campaign on social media, because it was her first shift, to post a picture of yourself if you are or were law enforcement as a rookie. Tens of thousands of cops from around the country have done it.
Absolutely. And, you know, and this is the thing, John. I think that, you know, this crystallizes, I think, for a lot of Americans, the fact that this job is never easy. And any call that you go on has the potential to be life-changing and life-ending.
Oh, yeah. I was talking about this on my show the last couple of days. You know, and you and I have spoken about this countless times, and I say it over and again. Two most dangerous things a police officer does, it's not SWAT, it's not warrants, it's those quote-unquote routine car stops and domestic violence calls. And this was the latter. This was a domestic violence call, should have been uneventful. It was anything but. The cops encountered a U.S. Army sergeant, staff sergeant, with a long gun who opened fire. These poor cops never had a chance. One dead, two shot. And these calls are incredibly, incredibly dangerous, and they always will be.
You know, and it was so it was about 12 hours, maybe about 24 hours before that call in Woodbridge, Virginia, down in North Charleston, South Carolina. Kimber Gist trying to make an arrest, a corporal there in North Charleston, South Carolina. And I thought this was, you know, I read a news story here from the Tribunist, which got into great detail the struggle that this corporal had here. She made a radio call that she was involved in a physical altercation with a suspect, and then they lost radio contact with her. At that moment, John, when you're a police officer and you're hearing the call over the radio, and then all of a sudden that officer's radio goes silent, what do you do? What is going through your mind at that point?
I'm going to say to you what I said on air about this exact story yesterday, because it just happened to me again. As you were recounting the particulars of the case, I got chills and goosebumps. The hair stands on end, because it does, because you think back to all those times you heard your friends screaming over the radio, your squad mates, your partners. And what you do is you race to that scene as fast as possible. But it feels like the car can't go fast enough, the lights aren't bright enough, the siren isn't loud enough.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when that radio goes dead, you have a knot in your stomach until you're at the scene.
And here's the thing. So it took about 13 minutes, it sounds like, John, for officers to be able to get to where Corporal Gist was, right?
Yeah, it did. It took a little bit of time for them to get there. It looked like they were occupied on other calls. And, you know, we talk about this often. These small departments don't have the staffing New York City, L.A., Chicago does, where multiple units are available and only a few minutes away, a few blocks away.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so, you know, just a quick side note before we get back to Corporal Gist's story here, because, you know, we often hear this from anti-gun activists who say, you know, you just have that cell phone. You don't need a firearm, John. Just have that cell phone, call police. You can't tell me that police were taking their sweet time to get to Corporal Gist. You cannot make that argument to me. Every officer who was responding was busting their ass to get there as fast as they could, and it still took 13 minutes because it does take some time.
It takes time, and I spoke to cops from her agency. She was very highly regarded. This was a very highly regarded sister officer. No, you're 100% right. They got there as fast as humanly possible.
So, you know, there are going to be occasions when you, as the victim of a crime, are going to be on your own, as Corporal Gist was. And Corporal Gist was shot 8 times. John, eight times she was shot. She survived, amazingly enough. And the very first Facebook post that she made after she came out of surgery said, "I'm alive. I fought. I made it. Hashtag sheepdog."
Yeah, I called her a rock star on air yesterday because it was the only word that came to mind. I didn't want to diminish the significance of what she went through, but you want her as your partner, right? If you're a street cop, that's who you want riding next to you every day or in the car responding with you. That's exactly the mentality. And you know what? She's going to go back on the street. She's going to do it again. And if the same situation went down, she'd do the same thing again. But you're right, Cam. Look, actually, in Corporal Gist's case, the police were on the scene, right? She was armed. She was trained. The police are not on the scene when a private citizen is the victim of a crime. That is why it is so critically important for people to learn how to handle a firearm and arm themselves. A friend of my fiance the other night posted a doctor, very nice woman, but very naive, that progressive mentality, posted something on Facebook about how, you know, technology is ruining kids because at 5 a.m, a big guy came to her door and claimed he left his cell phone in an Uber and he shouldn't have been knocking on doors at 5 a.m. And I said, she just thwarted a push in robbery by not opening the door. And when we said you should have called 911, she had that pie in the sky mentality of, oh no, he was just a nice kid in the neighborhood. And that, we all know that wasn't the case because later on the local police found him attempting to break into homes. So he absolutely was up to no good. But unfortunately, too many Americans have that naive, progressive, you know, mentality where everything is rainbows and unicorns, and they have that mentality until it's too late. And I really wish they didn't. I wish they would be much more responsible and conscious of their personal safety and arm up.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, I saw this was on Facebook. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum sent this to me over the weekend. I was talking with my wife about this video, and she had seen it too. I'm blanking on the name of the company right now, but there's an app. And this little video shows a woman, and she's walking through a parking garage, and a guy starts following her. And, you know, he goes to attack her. She turns around. She opens up this app, and a security guard on video camera says, "Stop. Stop. Your face is being captured. Stop. You need to turn and run away now." And the guy turns, and he runs away. And apparently, there's been a lot of discussion on Facebook that, wow, this is a great idea, using technology to save your life. And Julie's response was, "That's a load of crap." My wife's response was, "Holy cow, this is awful." Because, you know, there's this, you know, we talk about the anti-gun activists like to talk about a false sense of security that we have, by having a firearm. You want to talk about a false sense of security. Let's rely on your smartphone, John, and let's rely on the bad guy not having his face covered. Let's rely on you being able to have cell reception. Let's rely on it being a well-lit area so that your camera can capture this individual, right? And let's rely on this individual not simply rushing you, knocking your phone out of your hand, and assaulting you. I mean, this was such a bad idea.
Let's rely on this guy not being so pissed off that he kills you for capturing his face, and then they're investigating your murder, not your robbery or assault. I mean, it is just stupid. It is frankly stupid. Look, I have cameras around my house. Cameras are great as a secondary line of defense, prevention, and apprehension. But they're not my first. My firearm is my first. If I'm not home, my cameras are great to tell me what happened when I wasn't there. Property can be replaced. But I hear a bang at the door late at night. First thing in my hand is my handgun. And if I can get to it, my double barrel side-by-side 12-gauge. Because that is my best first line of defense. Without a doubt, indisputably.
Talking with John Cardillo, host of The John Cardillo Show, who is going to be at CPAC later in the week. You're going to be hanging out with us on Thursday. You excited?
I'm so looking forward to this. You honestly, it is like really like one of the things I'm looking forward to the most now after I found out today. That's going to be awesome.
I'm excited about it as well. And as I kind of jokingly said earlier, it's good to have muscle there at CPAC this year because I have no idea what's going to happen. Who knows? But I think you get this many passionate activists under one roof. It's always an interesting and exciting time. But this year it could be I have no idea, John. I have no idea.
You know, I got a couple of guys joining me. So one was CIA in the field in the Middle East for 10 years, and another is a current pretty senior guy in DEA. So we've got a lot of muscle that'll be at the event with us.
That's good. That's good. We won't sick the muscle. We're not Melissa Click or anything, all right?
But no. They're just, you know what? They're passive muscle.
Exactly. I just want to feel like a celebrity for a day, John. I just want to feel as protected as a celebrity at the Oscars, you know?
There you go. Exactly. And you have that, you know, you do have that level of celebrity now. You're entitled to that.
Yeah, sure. So is this going to be your first CPAC?
As somebody broadcasting, the show's on Radio Row. I've been about 4 or 5 years ago. I popped in, you know, a day here, a day there. But, yeah, actually broadcasting and being a part of it, it is.
That's going to be exciting. It's the Radio Row at CPAC really is one of those just truly unique experiences because, you know, you never know as a broadcaster, you never know who you're going to be talking to. And you could be talking to, Rooster, the 20-something-year-old mohawked activist. And then all of a sudden you're talking to a presidential candidate 5 minutes later. So it definitely keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to the most, that spontaneous sort of dynamic of the whole thing. I hear it's just awesome. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time. And we're looking forward to having you there. Listen, I do appreciate you coming on the program. Looking forward to spending even more time with you on Thursday.
Yeah, really looking forward to seeing you guys then. It'll be a great time. Thanks, as always, for having me. This stuff is so relevant and important.
Listen, absolutely, and it is relevant and important. This is why we talk about these stories, because there's so much, and you know this, John, as well as I do, when you're going through, you know, your list of things that you want to talk about in the hours of the day that you have allotted behind a microphone. There's no shortage of absolutely asinine, silly, frivolous stories to talk about. In fact, there's no shortage of those stories that we're expected to talk about, right?
Yeah, more content than time. I say it every single day, far more content than time.
Yeah. So, you know, you try to winnow down some of the extraneous stuff, and you get to the stuff that maybe other shows, maybe, you know, the networks aren't necessarily covering these stories, but it is important that these stories, you know, get some airtime. So we always love having you on the show.
Thanks very much. I will see you guys on Thursday, and hopefully we can socialize a little after the event on Thursday night as well.
I hope so. I'm still trying to talk Kurt Schlichter into karaoke one evening. So.
I'm in for that.
Oh, fantastic. All right.
Say no more.
Excellent. All right, John. We'll talk to you soon. John Cardillo joining us here on NRA News Cam and Company. There will be no smoke-filled back rooms for me. No, it'll be karaoke bars with Kurt Schlichter and John Cardillo. Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition is going to be joining us here in just a few minutes, talking about some pro-gun bills that are on the move there in Iowa, including the bill that the detractors are referring to as the toddler militia bill. Yeah, that phrase got a lot of play. I'll tell you that. Washington Post, we do not need a militia of toddlers. The Guardian newspaper, never too young. Iowa House passes bill to let children of all ages handle guns. Well, actually, children of all ages are allowed to handle guns in Iowa under parental supervision. You can currently handle a rifle. You can currently handle a shotgun under parental supervision, no matter your age. But you can't handle a handgun under parental supervision until you're 14. But why let the facts get in the way of a good headline, right? So we'll talk about it with Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition in just a little bit. Top of the hour, Lars Daleside, NRA ILA Media Liaison, Congressman Blaine Lukemeyer of Missouri, Gabby Hoffman, writing at the Washington Times, says disabled gun owners should not be disarmed, which does not seem to me to be a controversial position, but apparently somehow it is. Also, coming up top of the hour, we'll get into this a little bit more, but in San Francisco, where you might think they already have all of the gun control laws on the books that they could possibly dream of, you would again be wrong, because they found another one. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that Supervisor Mark Farrell will introduce legislation that will expand the city's landmark, that's the descriptor from the San Francisco Chronicle, the city's landmark gun storage law that requires handguns to be securely stored while at home. Now, this was passed a couple years ago. Why the lawmakers didn't decide to do this at the time, they now want to include long guns, so that every firearm that you own in the city of San Francisco would have to be kept under lock and key unless it was on your person, even in your home. Couldn't have it, you know, unlocked for self-defense. Have to have it on your person. Why didn't they do this 2 years ago when they passed the law that said you have to do this with handguns? Do you think it just slipped their mind? Do you think that they forgot? Or do you think that, well, we want to do this one step at a time so as to not be accused of being unreasonable? Not, again, that the California media would frankly call any gun control law unreasonable, but, you know, there are those national considerations. That's the only reason I can think of why you wouldn't have done this 2 years ago. I mean, unless, again, you forgot. In which case, it took you 2 years to remember. But we'll talk more about this coming up at the top of hour two as well. Stick around. When we come back here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition will join us. Stick around. We've got much more. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised $12,000. And we did that for a couple of years, and then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the roadshow. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and, you know, the little girl's got a wig on. She's been through hell. I can say hell, can I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia sent it, said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago. 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years older. This is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience that he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids, you know.
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Thanks again for being a part of this edition of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. Coming up, Congressman Blaine Lukemeyer of Missouri right now. I want to welcome from the Iowa Firearms Coalition, Mr. Kurt Liske. Kurt, how you doing, sir?
Cam, I'm doing well. Yourself? Happy Super Tuesday.
Happy Super Tuesday. Yeah, see, you guys get it out of the way early. You can just laugh at the rest of the country now. Although I have to say, one of the nice things about being in a state that is part of the Super Tuesday primary is that the commercials, you know, no candidate has the money to invest in the spending like they do in Iowa across, you know, a dozen plus states. So we don't get inundated with the campaign commercials like you guys did.
We get bombarded, and I take full responsibility for this, but I'm one of the weirdos that actually, well, maybe not the commercials, but I am a political junkie, and I really enjoy it. So
I'm a political junkie as well, and this is, I think this is going to be an election for the ages. I really do. This is going to be one for the history books or the neural implants or whatever it is that our grandkids use to learn. Hopefully we're still learning when our grandkids are around. But this is, I think, a really unique election year in American history. And so, you know, obviously we're all invested in this election. We want our rights to remain secure. But just as a student of American history and as a student of politics, this is also just kind of fascinating to watch this all unfold.
Yeah, things have really seemed to have gone from 0 to 100 within, well, even just the past couple of weeks, but definitely since the primary season has started. So
absolutely, we still have months to go. Now, in the legislature in Iowa, it looks like things are going pretty well here. We've got some pro-gun bills that are on the move, including a hearing today for the Hearing Protection Act. Right now, this is a House bill. It's passed out of the House, and it's over on the Senate side.
That is correct. This is, it's House File 2279, and what it is, it would legalize Iowans' ability to purchase suppressors. Now, obviously, we would still have to go through all the federal regulations, you know, ATF background checks, fingerprinting, wait times, all that stuff. But as it stands right now, that is not even an option by Iowa law. So that would be changed under this law, and you're absolutely correct, Cam. This passed out of the House just a very short time ago. It is now in the Senate. It has been assigned to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And from there, it's down into a three-person subcommittee. And that subcommittee is voting on it today, or we expect them to vote on it today. They're meeting on it. And from there, we believe it should pass out of the subcommittee and then hopefully from there pass out of the committee and then go to the full Senate. So.
And this is, you know, a topic that has seen a lot of attention around state legislatures over the past couple of years. And frankly, Kurt, it's been kind of refreshing to see that this is legislation that often, not always, but often passes with really large bipartisan majorities for whatever reason. And I think maybe a lot of it is legislator education. We're able to avoid the typically contentious fights, you know, that when you typically talk about a gun-related bill.
Yeah, Kim, we have seen that. This is the third year that we've run a suppressor legalization bill in the state of Iowa. And you're right, education is, it can't be stressed enough as far as in the legislature and really just in, for public sentiment as a whole about what a suppressor is, what it does, you know, how they are regulated, why, I mean, just quite honestly, why somebody would want to own one. I mean, that is a question that we get from people all the time. And once they get the facts and, you know, as long as they have even a halfway open mind, odds are that they are absolutely in support of it. They see no reason, especially if you're like us Iowans and you see the fact that there are 41 other states that already have these legalized, and then they see that there's a virtually zero crime associated with them. I mean, like I said, there's no logical case against it. To your point, I mean, this bill, like all of the bills that we've actually passed out of the House, had strong bipartisan support. We actually had every single House Republican voted for it, and we picked up 17 Democrats. I mean, this is it's one thing to say something is bipartisan supported, to have one or two guys that broke ranks from one party or another. But this is, I mean, this is true bipartisan support in every sense of the word.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and it seems like we saw that as well with the bill that a lot of the media are calling the toddler militia bill, Kurt.
Yeah,
this has been fun to talk about. And again, you want to talk about, you know, no good reason for something. Why? I still am unclear as to why Iowa law tells parents, yes, you are the ones who can determine when under your supervision your kids can use a rifle or shotgun, but not when it comes to a handgun. And so there is legislation that would simply tell parents it's up to you when under your supervision your kids want your kids to safely and responsibly handle firearms. But this is, Kurt, I almost think there's more objections to this outside of the state of Iowa than there are inside the state of Iowa.
Yeah, at this point, I mean, the story when it ran, when it first broke that the House passed this, what, about a week and a half ago or so,
mm-hmm.
almost 2 weeks ago, the gun control advocates around the country just latched on to their hashtag, which is their favorite way of communicating through hashtags, we know. And toddler militia was the one that just seemed to kind of rise to the top. And that's absolutely not at all what it is. I mean, the phrase toddler militia, you know, it portrays images of armed kids running wild, you know, and everything else, when in reality, that is absolutely flat out the opposite of what this bill would entail. If it were passed, it would simply allow parents in Iowa to shoot handguns with their children. And this is under direct supervision of either a parent or an instructor. A militia of kids running wild, carrying handguns is absolutely not the case. Now, like I said, I mean, I can't stress this enough. Under direct supervision is a very prominent part of that bill.
Mm-hmm.
And those in the opposition side of things have conveniently or not so conveniently left that portion of that specific detail out. Cam, you touched on one other important detail in the fact that, one, Iowa is the only state in the country that we know of that have this type of provision.
Yeah.
So when folks outside of Iowa say, oh, this is ridiculous, if they actually looked at their state laws, wherever they're at, guess what? This is already happening. And so it's a little bit hypocritical in that sense. The other really illogical portion to this is exactly what you said. My son and my daughter could go out right now and shoot a rifle. They could shoot my duck gun, you know, for my shotguns. And so realistically, if there was ever going to be a toddler militia, they would be already pretty well armed in the state of Iowa, and this wouldn't really change. It wouldn't do anything. This would already be the case. If there were to be a toddler militia, they would already be carrying around rifles and shotguns. But it goes to show the willful ignorance of quite frankly, too many people in the state legislature. So,
yeah.
Fortunately, the bill did pass through the state house, and it passed through with, again, bipartisan support. I'll be absolutely upfront and honest. We have an uphill battle in the Senate, but we believe if we can get a vote, we stand a very good chance of passing it. So.
Well, listen, I hope that you do. And again, this is... It should tell you everything you need to know about, where the opposition is coming from here when they can't be honest about what the bill actually does. Unfortunately, as you say, that doesn't necessarily translate into a full and free debate on the bill, but I hope that it does come up for a vote. And in the meantime, Kurt, I appreciate you coming on the program as always, sir. What's your advice? What should Iowa gun owners be doing this week?
Yeah, Iowa gun owners should be looking to the Iowa Firearms Coalition page. We actually are expecting subcommittee hearings on a number of the bills that passed through the House. We'll be posting updates through our website, iowafc.org, through our Facebook page, Twitter, I mean, all the usual social media. Odds are if you're on it, we're around there somewhere. We try to make ourselves as easy as possible to find. So we've got a series of, we call them advocacy campaigns. They're just pre-written emails that you can send in a matter of literally seconds. And it's a great way, easy, free, doesn't take up much time that you can, weigh in and help do your part to get the legislature motivated to pass these. So really just look for the messaging we'll be putting out in conjunction with our partners at the NRA. We'll be keeping people updated as best we possibly can.
Awesome. Well, listen, I always appreciate you coming on the program. Kurt, it's good talk with you, and look forward to doing this again soon.
Very good. Thanks, sir, and have a good afternoon.
You too. Kurt Liske joins from the Iowa Firearms Coalition. If I ever had a band, I think Cam Edwards and the Toddler Militia would be a pretty good name for that. Washington Post report, in a White House meeting today between President Obama and four top senators, Mitch McConnell, Harry Reid, Chuck Grassley, who is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and Patrick Leahy, the panel's ranking Democrat, did nothing to resolve the standoff over whether to fill the seat of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. I kind of think that would be the case. Seems like both sides have made their positions pretty clear here. Harry Reid telling reporters, and let me just quote the Washington Post here so you can get the full effect. Quote, "They were adamant," Reid told reporters, "of Republicans' refusal to hold hearings or offer any potential names for his consideration during what he and Leahy described as a very short meeting on the subject. There wasn't much said at the meeting. They think they're going to wait and see what President Trump will do, I guess, as far as the nomination is concerned," Reid added, referring to Donald Trump, the GOP presidential frontrunner. "We're going to continue beating the drums. All we want them to do is fulfill their constitutional duty and do their job. At this phase, they have decided not to do that." 1992, Joe Biden cannot be reached for comment. I mean, again, this, look, that's what they're going to say. But you can also go back to a period in time where you had members of this administration who were proclaiming that in the thick of a presidential election year, that the president should not nominate, shouldn't even send a name to the Senate for consideration. And if the president did, well, the then head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the position now occupied by Republican Chuck Grassley, back then in 1992, the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee said, listen, I don't think the president should send us a name. And if he does send us a name, I don't think we should hold hearings. Not because we want to be obstructionist, recalcitrant people who stand in the way of presidential prerogatives, but because there's no way in the thick of a presidential election year that this nominee is going to get a fair hearing. One way or the other, good, bad, or indifferent, Joe Biden, who was head of the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time, said there's no way that person is going to get a fair consideration. Everything at this point, way too politicized. So hold off. in case anybody on the Supreme Court resigns, I would tell President Bush, Biden said, don't send us anybody. Patrick Leahy said, quote, have the hearing, vote it down. Don't pretend it doesn't happen. We've done this a dozen times in presidential election years, had nominations. We are sending a signal to our country and to the world that it is a political institution and it's not supposed to be and it shouldn't be. Well, again, Joe Biden, back in 1992, said there was no way for a political body, the Senate, to hold confirmation hearings on a political appointment made by the president during an election year without it becoming completely political. That in this environment, there was no way that it was going to be anything other than political. What's changed now? It can't be this election is not as political as it was in 1992. Far from it, right? All right, stick around. Hour two of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. It's coming up right after this. We'll talk with Lars Dale, side NRA ILA Media Liaison, about Virginia's new reciprocity law. So stick around. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Speaking with Command Sergeant Major Patrick Valdez, he's retired, and he's now with Freedom Hunters. Patrick, thank you so much for being here, and we'll go right to the shot of what you tell us what you do, because this makes a very big impression when you wield this up to the set here. Tell us what's Freedom Hunters all about, and tell us about the chair.
Freedom Hunters, we're a nonprofit. We take all veterans, all wars, all branches, and outdoor shooting activities, to include hunting, target shooting, trap, long range, whatever we can get the guy out. It started out with the Wounded Warrior Program at Fort Carson, Colorado, and to get guys out of the barracks, kind of like what Healing Waters did. It's hunting and getting guys outdoors. When you get back from a combat environment, you want to go back and do the things you did before. You want peace, you want calm, you want quiet. And getting guys outdoors and gals is our primary mission.
So tell us about the chair you brought along.
The chair is an amazing device. It's the Action Track chair. It's an American-made. It runs 5 miles an hour. We can get guys, and I say guys meaning guys and gals, into places they can't get with a normal wheelchair. The little skinny tires get stuck in the mud, stuck in the sand. We put them in this, and we can get them right to a blind. We can get them to a duck or a goose blind. We've taken them elk hunting, mule deer out west. We've even taken them fly fishing. With it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it can go into a little bit of water, not a lot. Awesome. And it is battery operated. And it's just a great tool to get guys out. And it gives them independence. It gets the guys in a chair the freedom to get off the concrete and get into the snow, sand, dirt, whatever, and not have to worry about getting stuck.
So why did you do this?
You know, I started out as a patient in the program. I got injured in Iraq in February of 07. And Freedom Hunters came to me and said, when they were really small, they said, we heard you want to go do something different. And I'd never been waterfowl hunting, so they took me, and that's how I started with them. So I was initially a patient in the program. Cool. Then I became a mentor. Now that I'm retired and have a little more time on my hands, I work as an outreach coordinator helping the guys out.
That's awesome. Talking with Patrick Valdez with Freedom Hunters. So, Patrick, I was out at Camp Perry one time at the Nationals there, and I knew exactly what you were talking about. There was another organization who worked with the wounded vets, and they got them out hunting and shooting. Those guys just, you know, it's what they grew up doing. It's why a lot of them got into the service to begin with, and they're just so happy just to be getting out there again and just being out with the guys. It's hugely impactful to them.
Well, it's an independence issue. You know, when they get back, they're well medicated, they're being taken care of, they have all these appointments, and then they're like, I just want to go be by myself or get back into the wild. And especially at Camp Perry, it's a little sandy there.
Yeah.
And I've seen what wheelchairs do there, and they sink. And then all their buddies, usually four of them, drag them to the firing line. You know, and I've been on hunts where we didn't have a track chair available, and we had to drag the guy in his chair up to a blind.
Yeah. So something like that chair can't be cheap. So tell me, I'm obvious you guys probably need support. So we've got about 30 seconds left here. Tell us about Freedom Hunters. How can people get involved? How can they help out?
Freedomhunters.org, first of all. Come to our site. Vets can register and to get on a hunt themselves. Landowners can bring opportunities to shoot. There's the Independence Fund that's available, and Action Track Chair has their own 501c3 where there are scholarships available or funding available to get a chair on your own.
Patrick Valdez, Freedom Hunters, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for being here on NRA News. Please keep up good work and stay in touch, okay?
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Congressman Blaine Lukemire of Missouri coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Gabby Hoffman of Countercultured, writing at the Washington Times, says disabled gun owners should not be disarmed. And right now, I want to welcome to the program from NRA's Institute for Legislative Action, media liaison Lars Dealside is with us. Lars, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, Cam. Feeling excited here on primary day in the Old Dominion.
Yes. Have you already been to the polls today?
Already been to the polls, cast my vote, got my sticker, the whole nine yards.
I voted this morning as well. Now, granted, I live in a fairly rural area, so I was voter number 10 this morning. Was turnout pretty high where you were?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There were a lot of cars, a lot of people. Took about 15 minutes or so from once I walked in the door till I got to the place and cast the ballot. And
wow. That's for primary day, that's pretty interesting. I think turnout's going to be really high in Virginia today.
Well, we're seeing those kind of numbers all over the nation, it seems, out there. You got a lot of the candidates, got people excited and ready to go and cast their votes and see what's going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And people, you know, people are engaged, I think, in the state of Virginia. And I think that shows, you know, we were talking with Delegate Michael Webert on the program yesterday about the reciprocity bill that was signed by Governor Terry McAuliffe. And I think in part the fact that Attorney General Mark Herring's actions against reciprocity was undone and undone so quickly was because of the engaged gun owners and NRA members that we have here in Virginia.
Well, it wasn't just those here in Virginia. Definitely, when you look at the concealed carry permit holders in Virginia, we're talking nearly half a million people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a half a million people who their rights were threatened when traveling to basically half of the United States, you know, 25 overall. And you had those people, as well as the 6 million or so that had the right before the agreement was going to be canceled, that coming into the state of Virginia that were affected. So we're talking nearly 7 million people total, and these are traveling for fun, for business, to visit family, whatever the case may be. So you have the people that were voicing their opposition. You had business leaders that were voicing their opposition. It's just a whole lot of things that I guess weren't considered when the decision was initially made.
Absolutely. And with the signing of this legislation, now we go not just to restoring those reciprocity agreements, but the decision making is going to be in the hands of the Virginia State Police now. And they've been directed by the legislature that they shall reach agreements with other states. I mean, it sounds like this is going to expand the number of states that Virginia has reciprocity agreements with.
You know, that's what we're thinking overall. You know, there are a number of states out there that have similar legislation to what we do now here in Virginia, which is if there is a state out there that will recognize that, you shall recognize them, and they will in kind, hence the term reciprocity, give you the same rights that you have in your home state.
So it does have to be noted, Lars, that Michael Bloomberg wasn't real happy with this, right?
Yeah, we did read a few things from both Mr. Bloomberg and his group that they were not too happy with the way that this turned out. But when you look, you know, you've got to go back to November with the elections. I mean, he poured all of that money into the state to hope to turn the tide in the Virginia Senate. And what he got was not quite the results that they were thinking. I mean, there were some areas that they were outspending the pro-gun candidates, a 3-to-1 margin, and the success was very, very limited. In fact, I was talking with a colleague earlier today and said, you know, his probably his biggest success was McPike in Senate District 29. And McPike won with, I think it was 53.7% of the vote, which was the lowest overall percentage since 1967.
Wow.
So in that same district, Obama won in 2012 with, I think it was 63% of the vote. And the Democrats have held that seat for ages, well, since 67, at least according to the research I was doing earlier. So if you have something that they believe to be such a hot-button issue and is going to really turn the tide and they see such poor results, that's why you got to sit back and rethink that plan of attack. Maybe this isn't something that you should be playing with.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, look, in Virginia, you know this as well as I do. Virginia, like most of the rest of the country, we are seeing large numbers of new gun owners. We are seeing people who are becoming concealed carry holders. And frankly, you know, I think that voter intensity among that group far outpaces the intensity of the avid anti-gun voter.
Well, definitely. I mean, with us here at the NRA, the people that work in the building, the volunteers that we have out in the field, we're very passionate about this issue. And so much so that we talk to friends, we talk to family, we'll go out, we'll talk to groups. We'll hold seminars and workshops and talk about the different things that people can do with their politicians. And what we see on the other side, it's not necessarily the volunteers that are doing it, but the paid employees. And what we like to refer to as the AstroTurf instead of grassroots type groups. And there's just a different level of passion. And you're going to get more people out there pulling more voting levers, talking to their friends, stumping with politicians and the newspapers and the radio shows. And because of that, it's sort of a wave that you can't ignore, at least if you're going to hope to be politically relevant come the next election cycle.
Absolutely. It's going to make for a really fun NRA annual meeting this year in Louisville, Kentucky, I think, too.
Oh, definitely, definitely. We got action down in Kentucky, too. There's all sorts of activity right now. We just saw that there was a permitless carry legislation thrown into the mix.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It just came across my wire. It's a bill, let's see, where are we looking at? Bill 531, sent forth by Representative Hubert Collins. And it says we'll allow for the lawful concealed handgun carry for self-defense without needing to first obtain government-issued license. So Kentucky's going to have a little bit of activity sometime soon.
How about that? All right. Well, listen, Lars, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's always good catching up with you, and hope we get to see you. Are you going to be out at CPAC at all this week?
I will be out of town, actually. You're going to have to rely on Catherine and Amy for your fun.
Well, enjoy yourself, and I'm sure we'll get a chance to catch up soon.
Yes, sir. You have a good day, Cam.
All right, you too. Lars Daleside joins NRA ILA Media Liaison with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. How about that? A little bit of news dropping there with Lars. Permitless carry introduced in the state of Kentucky. This is permitless carry is going to Governor Tomlin's desk in West Virginia. Now, he's expected to veto it, but the votes are there for a veto override. I was really hoping that the state of Virginia would also get our permitless carry bill to Governor McAuliffe's desk this year, but unfortunately it was not to be in this legislative session, but we'll be back with it next session, I am sure. Now, Congressman Blaine Lukemire, Missouri, as I mentioned, going to be with us in just a few minutes. Gabby Hoffman writing at the Washington Times later on in the hour. We've been talking about Super Tuesday a little bit today in the election season and just what a crazy election year it is right now. And that there seems to be that general consensus, at least. We can all agree that this is a unusual election year in our history, right? So I just got through reading a book, came out 3 weeks ago or so. And it's by the gentleman has passed away now, Fang Lizi is his name. He was a physicist at the University of Arizona for about 20 years, fled China after the Tiananmen Square uprising in the late 1980s, spent about 13 months in the U.S. Embassy there in Beijing before being allowed to leave by the Chinese government and travel originally to England for 6 months, and then he settled in the United States. But he was one of the guys who was responsible for not directing these student uprisings, but for speaking out and sort of giving voice to these students in the late 1980s that it was okay to call for things like free elections. And he was the president or vice president of a university at the time, and he said, I'll have your back when you speak out, when you use the voices that you have to demand the rights that supposedly you have under the Chinese Constitution, I'll have your back. Well, the government didn't have his back. But I was struck today as I was reading this book about the descriptions that he used when talking about the conditions that led to this moment in Chinese history in the late 1980s, where all of a sudden you had this protest movement speak up in the face of authoritarian crackdowns on speech. Now, he was a physicist. He was talking about, he made a reference in this book to atomic energy. And he says, as it happens, atomic explosions provide a surprisingly apt metaphor for Chinese society in the spring of 1989. He said there are three elements basically necessary for the detonation of an atomic bomb. Fissionable material in sufficient amount, a means to coalesce the fissionable material into a critical mass, and timely neutron bombardment. And he said China in 1989 had, metaphorically speaking, all three. And just listen to how he described Chinese society at that moment in time. He said, first, the supply of fissionable material. Ever more obvious corruption, stalled political reform, and tight constraints on freedom of speech and of the press were producing anger, frustration, and resentment among students, intellectuals, workers, small-time entrepreneurs, party functionaries, and even some high-ranking officials. The potential for explosion was growing steadily. Huh. That sound anything like how Americans are feeling about our own society today? A lot of corruption, stalled political reform, growing constraints on the freedom of speech and of the press, making people a little ticked off. And into that, the kind of crummy economy that we've been seeing here. Second, he said factors that could bring the fissionable material to a critical mass. And Fang noted that in 1989, there were several anniversaries. There was the 70th anniversary of the May 4th movement. There was the 40th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. There was the 10th anniversary of the Democracy Wall movement. And those moments, he said, could become vortices in the sea of unorganized popular resentment. Well, here we have an election year, right? That's perhaps one of the biggest vortices in the sea of unorganized popular resentment that you could have, the opportunity to go to the polls and cast your vote. And third, he said, the neutron bombardment. Flying neutrons, he said, were in pretty steady supply. Small skirmishes kept popping up, now here, now there, in response to various ham-handed moves by the government. Do we not see, again, some ham-handed moves by the government right now when it comes to, for instance, Hillary Clinton's email server? Do we also not have those sort of moments that are causing these small skirmishes? The death of Antonin Scalia could be seen as one of those moments where now you've got a president saying, I'm going to nominate somebody. You've got the Republicans in the Senate saying, well, we're not going to hold hearings. President floats out a name of a Republican governor. The Republican governor says, nah, not interested, thank you. Now, in China in 1989, we know how it turns out, right? The revolutionary movement, the student movement, didn't succeed. It was crushed by the communist government that sent in some 200,000 soldiers into their capital city to massacre civilians. But Feng Lizi points out the conditions that were necessary in order for that moment to even arrive. And it seems to me like, again, when you gauge the mood of the electorate, in the United States right now, you find, again, a great amount of discontent with Washington, D.C. You find a great amount of distrust in many of the institutions in Washington, D.C., and throughout our culture and our society. And you keep finding these moments where, you know, Americans maybe could come together. Like after the death of somebody like Antonin Scalia, we could have, you know, a moment, have an hour where we come together, but it doesn't happen. Instead, almost immediately, everything becomes politicized, sides are chosen, and if you're on the side that says, oh, good, now we get to nominate somebody to replace Scalia, then you feel like it's okay to find glee and joy in the death of another human being. And again, I don't know how this election season will turn out and shape up. But it did strike me as I was reading this book today. It's called The Most Wanted Man in China. That's the name of the memoir. And he actually wrote it while he was in the U.S. Embassy, trying to leave the country. It just struck me that there were some similarities, anyway, to how Americans are feeling right now, that discontent. And maybe that explains, again, why this feels like such a unique moment in our electoral history. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout, Congressman Blaine Lukemeyer of Missouri will join us on the program. Gabby Hoffman writing at the Washington Times later in the hour as well. Stick around. We'll be back with much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Philip Hosnoot with Salted Earth. Philip, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
All right. So tell us, what is Salted Earth? What do you guys do?
So Salted Earth is a technology startup. We're based out of Arizona right now. Been in business about a year, focused primarily on dry fire training, bringing targets to market to help people train anywhere and in any environment.
So when you say technology startup, what kind of stuff? You've got a product here you're going to show us. Is it mainly oriented towards the firearms industry, or is it all sorts of stuff?
We're basically exclusively in the firearm industry right now.
Okay. And what is it that you do? What kind of product?
So this is the first product that we're launching in a lineup. It's part of the Atlas series, which stands for Adaptive Training Laser System. It's a whole system of targets.
Wait, so we get to see the first product you're doing?
This is the first product that we're launching, debuted here at the SHOT Show. It's a reactive dry fire laser training target. It's the kind of the one of the many sizes we'll be coming out with. Has an 8x8 array of LEDs, and it allows you to basically simulate most of the types of trainings you'd normally do at the live fire range.
So how does that work?
So we have it works with any red, green, or infrared laser. This is a next-level training training pistol. It'll work with anything, including Crimson Trace. Works with flashlights as well. So you can basically configure it through our mobile app to run any standardized training that you normally would.
Very cool. So it gives you an opportunity, a way to train without having to actually be on the range.
Right, exactly.
Very safe, very portable, very anything. So it's the company's called Salted Earth. What's that product?
That's the Atlas 8.
The Atlas 8, and so does it come sort of together as a kit, or is that just a separate part of it?
Right now it's a separate part. We're looking at potential partnerships down the road.
How can you get more information about your company and about the Atlas 8?
You can go to thesaltedearth.com. We have a lot of information up there, a lot of videos of it in action, how to use it, that kind of thing.
Phil with Salted Earth, thank you for this great new product. Thanks for showing it here on NRA News, and thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well, and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
So I'm glad to hear.
Tell us, what is Armed in Heels all about?
So Armed in Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed and Heels to support the working woman, the empowered woman, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried, you were terrified. Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried, and then he put it away. And
I see.
It maybe took 2 years to get the guts to do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No way.
So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. You seem to have it figured out. I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed and Heels?
So you can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed and Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for tuning into NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Gabby Hoffman, writing at the Washington Times, in the case of Harvey Limbo up in Maine, will join us a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, what a welcome to the program from the Show Me State of Missouri. Congressman Blaine Lukemire is with us. Congressman, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you, Cam. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Listen, we always love having you on the show. And unfortunately, you know, this topic, I would like to have thought by now, Congressman, we could be talking about something other than Operation Choke Point, but unfortunately, the administration just doesn't want to move on.
No, they're continuing this onslaught, I call it, against legal people doing legal business with the FDIC and DOJ trying to shut off financial services to these individuals and businesses across entire industries. And so a couple weeks ago, we were actually able to pass a bill in the House. We've managed to get it through the committee and on the floor and passed it. Last week, after 2.5 years of working with individuals and groups and the agencies to try and find ways to solve this problem. So the bill heads to the Senate finally, and hopefully it will get over there and get passed and, you know, solve some of the problems that we have with this overreach by the administration and trying to shut off, especially in the case of dear listeners, folks who are interested in Second Amendment rights with regards to being able to own, operate, shoot guns, manufacture ammunition, manufacture guns themselves, as well as sell them at gun shops. So it's a really important bill, and we were glad to be able to get something done along those lines.
This is the Financial Institution Consumer Protection Act, correct?
Right.
And, you know, Congressman, I suppose there were some who would say, look, the Obama administration says that they never targeted the firearms industry anyway. The FDIC has pulled this guidance down that talked about these high-risk industries. So why is this bill even necessary? Why is this bill even needed at this point?
Well, we have a website, an email address, chokepointstory@mail.house.gov, that we continue to get stories from around the country with regards to these activities still going on. The FDIC, to their credit, about a year ago, implemented many of the changes in my bill that they should be doing right now, and they've actually done a lot of this. However, it doesn't mean that they can't have sort of a wink and nod with their examiners when they go into banks and start talking about these things. Also, the Department of Justice, unless we change their method of operating, that culture still is in place in their agency, and this bill put some protections in there that gets them back within the confines of the law that they are reinterpreting to try and go after banks. You know, we believe that everybody is entitled to due process. And what is going on here is that the DOJ and FDIC are not allowing due process. They are themselves the arbiters of who can be in business and who cannot. We believe the marketplace should settle that. And if somebody is doing something illegal, then bring suit against them, take them to court. That's the process. Don't intimidate banks into cutting off financial services so that they don't have the ability to do business. It's really a sad story. Even the agencies themselves. We got copies through the Oversight and Government Reform Committee of each agency's internal emails. And each one of them, their legal department, said they didn't think that these departments had the legal right to do what they're doing and instead are doing it anyway, which sent a chill down the spine of everybody from the standpoint that you have the lead law enforcement agency in this country, the Department of Justice, who their own internal attorneys say we shouldn't be doing this and are doing it anyway. Holy cow, what can you say about that?
I guess one question that I have immediately is, okay, so if the attorneys are saying don't do this, who's saying go ahead?
Well, obviously the folks at the top are allowing this to continue. There is, I said earlier, there is a culture within these agencies that says we don't like certain agents, certain activities. We don't like certain industries. For instance, we don't like the gun industry. We think it should go away. Therefore, we're going to go to the banks and we're going to tell the bankers, you know, this is really a bad group of people to be doing business with. They could cause you reputational risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people are producing guns that can do harm to people. You should be very careful about this. And they continually harass the bankers until the bankers throw their hands up and say, we don't need the harassment. We don't need this problem. We've even got a copy of an email that threatened the banker if he didn't stop doing business with a particular entity, he was going to be harassed and audited until he did. This is the length to which you're going. My bill forces the FDIC to stop that and put in writing any time that they're going to request a termination of an account. Therefore, there is a paper trail to show who authorized this all the way up to the regional vice president, so that this is not going to be a rogue examiner somewhere. They're going to have some people up the top to show their cards on what's going on so that we can actually stop this nonsense. So it has been curtailed. I will give them credit. It's not as bad as it was, but it is still going on. And as long as it's going on, we've got to continue with the bill, and we've got to stop it.
You know, as you say, it is apparently still going on. We talked with Kelsey Harkness of the Daily Signal just a couple days ago, and she was talking about a couple of individuals in Ohio who very recently, you know, got letters from their financial institutions they were trying to do business with, and sorry, you are denied due to industry was the response that one of them got.
That's the code word for choke point. And as I was saying, this email address that I have, the week that we had our bill up on the floor and it passed, there we got a story from a payday loan group in Northwest Arkansas, and 2 weeks before that we had a credit bureau in California, and I think a couple weeks before that we had a tobacco shop in Florida. This is still going on across the country, across all these different industries that the Department of Justice and FDIC have a political bent or a value judgment against, and as a result, you know, that's fine. You know, that's a personal opinion. That's not supposed to be what this agency is supposed to do. They're supposed to enforce the existing law, not their personal and political ideologies or personal value bents. And this is where we have the rub. They're not enforcing the law. They're trying to impose their own views, their own ideology on these banks by choking off financial services to the very people who need those services to exist with their businesses.
Well, listen, Congressman, I do appreciate all of the work that you have done and continue to do on this. What should gun owners and our audience members do to help this bill along right now?
Well, I would say you need to be contacting your senators because this is where the bill is headed. Continue to contact your congressman. Let them know that you support this bill. Let them know, if it doesn't get through the process this year, we're going to bring it up again next year. We're going to start all over again. We're going to keep the pressure on these agencies because, as I said, there is a culture within these agencies that allows this to happen. They know this is wrong. They know this is not right. They know that they have people within their agency that have this bent on how they want to try and enforce their own will on the banks and therefore cut off services, and we've got to stop that. And I think tell stories. Contact your congressmen and your senators with your own stories of how this is going on within your circle of friends or people you know who've been affected by this, and then let my office know. We want to continue to be the point of the spear for this effort so that we can get the stories back to my colleagues to say, hey, look, this isn't going. And then when we talk to the FDIC and Department of Justice, we can throw these stories out there and say, here, look at this stack of stories.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's come in here in the last several months. You guys have still got a problem. You still have a culture within your agency that allows it to happen. It's time to stop it. And so we're going to continue to push, and we hope that everyone listening today will contact their congressman and their senator to let them know that this is not what they think of the way administration should be behaving. We need to let the marketplace decide who is successful and who is not, and not have winners and losers picked by the Department of Justice and the FDIC.
Well, Congressman, again, thank you so much for coming on the program today. It is always a pleasure, and hope we get to do this again soon.
Always a pleasure, Cam. Hopefully we can make this the last discussion of choke point as we pass the bill, and we can protect our citizens and their Second Amendment rights.
Let's hope, Congressman. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon. Congressman Blaine Lukemeyer from Missouri joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company, again, talking about the Financial Institution Customer Protection Act, which has passed out of the House, now headed over to the Senate. So if you are a gun owner, if you, you know, you don't have to be a gun owner to be concerned about this. If you don't like the idea of the federal government telling banks, hey, here are some industries that, you know, you could really open yourself up to some risk here if you conduct business with these industries that are legal businesses, legal industries. If that bothers you at all, make sure that your senator knows what you think about the Financial Institution Customer Protection Act. Gabby Hoffman, as I mentioned, writing at the Washington Times, will join us here in just a couple of minutes. The folks at Twitchy have the story of Larry Wilmore. I wonder if Media Matters for America, Cameron, will write about Larry Wilmore, who imagined using Antonin Scalia's pillow to murder Donald Trump on The Daily Show this week. Do you think Media Matters will write about that?
I'm guessing, you know, as much as we disagree with them, I'm guessing they have some sort of maybe sense of humor or want quality entertainment. So I imagine, like the rest of America, even Media Matters probably just watch Larry Wilmore. Disagree with him as we will.
So they just didn't see it.
I can't imagine.
He's still on?
Yeah, we have our issues with Timothy Johnson when it comes to politics, but I don't think even he watches Larry Wilmore. But I'm sure we'll hear about it if he does.
Well, poor Greg Polowitz, or whoever the Twitchy editor was who found this story. But yes, Larry Wilmore on Wednesday of last week. And again, here's how you know that nobody watches The Daily Show anymore, because this is from Wednesday of last week, and people are just now finding out about it. Said, sorry, everyone, I don't want to give him any more oxygen. That's not a euphemism, by the way. I mean it literally. Somebody get me the pillow they used to kill Scalia, and I'll do it. I'll do it, he said. And then demonstrated, according to Deadline Hollywood, before saying, I could get in trouble for that, actually. Could, but apparently he didn't, because, again, this was last Wednesday. So I guess, Cameron, maybe an update to the if a tree falls in the forest, right? Nobody hears it, doesn't make. So if a quote-unquote comic talks about murdering a presidential candidate on his show and nobody's watching, do they get suspended?
There should be a pool somewhere. Who's going to get canceled first? Because I keep wondering in my head if it's going to be him or Seth Meyers or Trevor Noah or any of these late night shows that have made zero dent. And I'm just shocked that they're still on the air.
You ready for this? Here's what's going to happen. It's going to be like a merry-go-round. So Colbert replaces Seth Meyers, right? And then Seth Meyers replaces Larry Wilmore. Larry Wilmore replaces Trevor Noah, and Trevor Noah replaces Stephen Colbert.
You know, it's sir, and I forgot Colbert is really, you know, killing CBS as well. That was an obvious a mistake, which I think we all saw. You know, everyone was expecting the character, and everyone who was warning CBS viewers that the real Mr. Colbert was going to be the host. Obviously didn't listen, but it's kind of like when you say something like that, I always think about these head coaches in the NFL who just completely fail in one city, but it doesn't matter. You know, if you've had an NFL head coaching job, you are pretty much guaranteed another job in some other city for life, whether it be, even if it's just an assistant coach. But yeah, you're right. They just shuffle them around. It's not the craziest idea.
You would see, let's put it this way, none of those individuals that we just mentioned, even if they don't just, you know, take each other's job, They'll move to HBO, have a weekend show. Maybe MSNBC will decide, hey, you know, what would be great is to give one of these comedians a job on an actual news channel and see how that works out. But you're right.
I heard they have an opening.
There is that. You've got the. I've heard that too. It's an irregular show. It's not going to be on every weekend. Just you know, let's get that clear right up front. You'll be preempted quite a bit, by the way. But you know, looking for a part-time gig. And what do you bet that Melissa Harris-Perry does not end up as the host of The Daily Show or The Nightly Show or The Late Show with Stephen Colbert? I'm just guessing. She's not going to be on any of those shows as a host or a guest. But then again, I won't be either. So it all evens out, I suppose. All right, when we come back here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company, Gabby Hoffman writing at the Washington Times about the case of Harvey Limbo up in Maine, the disabled gun owner, repeated victim of burglaries when he bought a firearm to defend himself and then had to use it. Harvey's landlord decided to kick him out of his apartment. Yeah, we'll talk about it with Gabby Hoffman coming up right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
With Kellyanne Pigeon with Armed and Feminine. Kellyanne, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell folks, what is Armed and Feminine? What do you do and why?
Armed and Feminine is my business that I created to teach firearms training for women only. When I got into shooting several years ago, there was no one I could find that was female. And it was a little difficult because men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
No.
So I went to an NRA training through the Well-Armed Woman and became an instructor. And I came back and started this. And it took off like wildfire. People came from all over the tri-state area. I'm in Pennsylvania. And they loved the idea of women teaching women. You know, we have to know, how does this work? What is it called? What does it do? We have to feel things, touch things. And that's what the entire classes are based around, is women teaching women. Because we're different. We have smaller hands. We're not as strong. We're curvier in different ways. Totally different on how you have to learn how to shoot.
Right, and especially with certain firearms, the fit, whether it's revolver, semi-automatic, if you handgun, it's a different fit for a woman's hands versus a man's.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the draws about my class, is that when someone comes, all they have to do is bring a lunch. I bring everything, eyes, ears, materials, and an array of firearms, and so do my other instructors. So they have an opportunity to pick and choose from all different firearms to see what fits for them. And everything is different. And it's funny, I have a video out that akins the firearm to buying your bra, if we can go there on this segment.
Of course, we always go there here.
But, and I say that nobody can buy your firearm but you. You know, when someone said, oh, my husband bought this for me, and I just want to roll my eyes and go, really?
Honey, I got you a 44 Magnum. It's called the Dirty Harry Special. Enjoy.
Exactly. And they're never going to want to shoot again. Like, guys are like, honey, try this big, big firearm. So we start with 22s till we get all the fundamentals down pat, and then we move up to 380s and 9s until they figure out what it is that they like. But I tell them, you know, it's just like your bra. It's got to be comfortable. It's got to fit right. You've got to be able to wear it every day, and it's got to be able to do its job. So only you can do that.
Perfect. Speaking with Kellyanne Pigeon with Armed and Feminine. So, Kellyanne, you say you're from PA. What part of the state?
I live near Pittsburgh.
Okay. I'm a PA guy myself, and in Virginia now, but it's always good to have a fellow Pennsylvanian here.
I find them everywhere. Actually, I found a man right who lives not by me from
That's
here.
Awesome. So why was it important that you do? You talked about you didn't find it, but you went way beyond, I can't find a woman to instruct me. You started this whole thing, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of drive.
It does.
What drove you to do this?
I know how much I enjoyed it and what learning this trade did for me in terms of confidence, et cetera. I'm all about mentoring women. I won the Athena Award locally for mentoring women and trying to help move them. And in the classes, I found women who were housekeepers, from housekeepers to attorneys and everybody in between. And what I saw is that women who may be fearful in one way or another, once you teach them how to safely handle a firearm, their confidence just goes through the roof. And if they're having a bad day or they feel like their back's up against the wall for something, they just have to remember, hey, I know how to shoot a gun, and I can do that pretty well. I can do anything. And so, you know, I just enjoy helping people. My real job is in human services, and folks look to me for leadership sort of all the time. And so it was just sort of another calling that I had, and I found it to be a passion. And I thought, if I'd only started this 10 years earlier, this would have been awesome. So I enjoy it. I enjoy every minute of it.
How can folks get more information about Armed and Feminine?
Actually, they can visit my website. It's armedandfeminine.com, and all the tabs are there, from frequently asked questions, class descriptions. All my classes are pretty much sold out for the next season. It's crazy. My entire 2016 season sold out in 5 days. 5 days. I had to add more slots to that during the week to try to just meet the demand.
Okay. So before we run out of time here,
sure.
What's your message to women who are watching us going, should I try that? What do you tell them?
Don't be afraid. You can conquer your fears. It's worth it. And we need to move from being the protected to becoming the protector. And women will save the Second Amendment.
Wow. That's awesome.
Well, they will.
That's awesome.
Give me 30 more seconds. Because women who are the matriarchs of their family, whatever they like, believe in, and support, so will their children. And so women are on the move, and we're moving this, and we're going to be a big part of saving the Second Amendment.
Colleen, thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
John, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. Brian Lilly of the Rebel in the Blaze next hour. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media right now. I want to welcome, from Countercultured, writing at the Washington Times, Gabriella Hoffman. Gabby, how you doing?
Doing well. Happy Super Tuesday.
Happy Super Tuesday. Yes. I don't know if happy is the right word to describe the electorate either the Republican or Democratic side of the aisle, but at least, you know, after today, Super Tuesday will be done with, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, we should try to remain optimistic. I don't know. But we'll see.
You know, listen, I have no idea how the election season is going to turn out. I'll be the first to admit it. And I think that basically every so-called expert should also go ahead and admit it. They were all kind of flying blind this year. And you know, one of the things that I am truly glad to see is that voter turnout appears to be up substantially, at least among the Republican primaries that we've seen so far. And I hope that trend holds true.
Yeah, it's encouraging, but we may have to worry whom they're supporting and if it's truly genuine, but we'll see what happens there.
We will. CPAC will be interesting this week.
Yeah. It could either be a circus or it could be a
cage
lot of fun.
Match.
We'll be able to see firsthand, and hopefully we'll get together, and I'll see you there.
I hope so. So you've got a piece in the Washington Times right now, and I think this is a fantastic piece. It really, I think, highlights a story that should have gotten more attention than it did. Often, these armed citizen stories that we talk about, they never get beyond the local media. And this certainly was covered in Maine, but it didn't get a lot of national attention. Harvey Limbo.
Correct.
67 years old, you write, is a retired police officer and a lobsterman who is bound to a wheelchair, currently lives in Section 8 housing due to his disability, been burglarized 6 times in the past 6 years. He bought himself a firearm after the most recent burglary on August 31st, and it was the day before he had bought that gun, August 30th. He used that firearm to defend himself, and after he defended himself in his own home, Gabby, his landlord says, well, you're not allowed to have a gun here. You've got to go, Harvey.
Yeah, essentially he said because it violates the housing development's code, which forbids firearms, the possession of firearms, he essentially is evicting him. But Mr. Lembo has luckily been supported by the NRA in filing a countersuit. So he may be able to stay in his current residence, but if they get their way, sadly, he'll be evicted and homeless, and that would be really a travesty for such an individual like him.
Of course. Now, you do point out that lawmakers in Maine have introduced a bill a couple of days ago that would protect gun owners like Harvey Limbo. And you also point out some court cases from around the country, including one in Maine, dealing with the Portland Housing Authority that were prohibiting firearms on on-site housing as a violation of the state's firearms preemption law. So there may be precedent there to protect Harvey Limbo, but it seems also around the country that we have seen courts take up this issue, and they have said, yes, you have the right to own a firearm, even if you live in Section 8 housing, even if you live in subsidized housing, or you are disabled, you've still got your Second Amendment rights.
Yes, because if they receive public subsidies, they're essentially wards of the state. They're not entirely public. And if the state has an amendment in their constitution that says residents are allowed to keep and bear arms, essentially law will trump their certain edicts that they've put in place. And it's not to say that it's an assault on private property, but if you're receiving subsidies, you're beholden to the state. I mean, not that I condone that one bit, but when it comes to disarming people, that's a pretty dangerous thing to do, especially if current law suggests that any public entity should be allowed to enforce Second Amendment rights.
Absolutely. And these cases, by the way, so you've got one in Colorado, the Wilmington Housing Authority case. For folks who watch this program, you see Josephine Byrd in the Freedom Safest Place spot. She was one of the plaintiffs there challenging that ban on firearms in the Wilmington Housing Authority. And then the third case that you mentioned, actually from San Francisco, right?
Yeah.
Where the San Francisco Public Housing Authority was told you cannot ban handguns from your property.
Yeah, and they ultimately said that legal firearms are to be permitted in San Francisco, which is no bastion of gun rights. And I think they just got rid of their last gun shop, from what Chris Chang, the competitive shooter, has said. So that's interesting that even a place as liberal and anti-gun as San Francisco would vote in favor of firearm rights.
You know, and it's interesting, Gabby, because this is an issue where, you know, if you are a quote-unquote gun safety activist, you shouldn't have a problem with Harvey Limbo owning a firearm, right? If you're not anti-gun, you're just in favor of a few common sense gun safety regulations, then why should you be opposed to someone like Harvey Limbo or anybody else living in Section 8 housing having a firearm? And yet we haven't heard from these supposed gun safety organizations about Mr. Limbo's case, have we?
No, because they believe anyone who decides to be independent and not rely on the government for self-protection or things of that sort, they're essentially not worthy of being dignified or being profiled because they betray the narrative that the left, and especially the anti-gun left, has set out. So there's no need for someone like a Harvey Limbo to be heralded by the left because he doesn't subscribe to their worldview.
Yeah. I mean, I hate that it's as simple as that, but it kind of is as simple as that, isn't it? Well, listen, I do appreciate you highlighting Harvey's story. We'll be following the bill in Maine, again, just introduced a couple of days ago. But I would not be surprised to see this actually pass out in Maine. I know that this was a big story in Maine, and there were a lot of supporters of Harvey Limbo. I don't think you found too many folks in the state who were pleased with the prospect of Harvey being turned out of his apartment for defending his life.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are sympathetic to his case, and hopefully he'll be able to stay in his house and others like him will be also granted the same privilege or the same rights to have their firearms in public housing as well.
Absolutely. Gabby, thanks so much for coming on the program, and look forward to seeing
you're
in a couple days here.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you in a few days.
All right. Gabriella Hoffman from Counterculture. Always a pleasure. You can find her latest piece again on Harvey Limbo at the Washington Times. Now, Gabby also points out, besides the court cases, Maine's state constitution is one of the many state constitutions around the country that has its own protection of the right to keep and bear arms. Article 1, Section 16 of Maine's constitution says, quote, "Every citizen has a right to keep and bear arms, and this right shall never be questioned." But what does it mean? Oh, maybe it means that every citizen has the right to keep and bear arms in the service of a militia. Or maybe it means that every citizen has the right to keep and bear arms as long as these arms are approved, maybe single-shot derringers, maybe a taser could be considered arms. Maybe we can question it just a little bit. I know it says the right shall never be questioned, but surely they couldn't have meant never be questioned. We have to question it a little bit, right? Again, the state constitution is pretty clear. Every citizen in the state of Maine has the right to keep and bear arms. Doesn't say unless you live in subsidized housing. Doesn't say unless you're disabled. Unless your landlord sets a provision that says, nope, you can't have a gun. Every citizen has a right to keep and bear arms, and this right shall never be questioned. Well, again, we'll follow Harvey Limbaugh's case as the, and not just the case, but the legislation there in Maine as the bill makes its way through the legislature. Again, it's not a case that got a lot of national attention, but thankfully, there were folks talking about it in the state of Maine when it happened, and they've continued to talk about this as well. And again, I haven't seen too many people. I haven't seen anybody, actually. I've not seen one single person in all of the coverage in Maine, not one of the anti-gun groups, not one of the individuals working with Bloomberg to pass that universal background check bill. I haven't seen one of those individuals say anything about Harvey Limbaugh. I haven't seen them speak out in support of Harvey Limbaugh. And I haven't seen them say, you know what, I think Harvey should be removed from his apartment. I don't think Harvey should be allowed to live there anymore. I'm perfectly fine with this provision that tells people like Harvey Limbaugh, you can't protect yourself with a firearm in your home. They don't want to talk about that story. They don't want to talk about Harvey. Now, in Alaska, we've got campus carry legislation that is on the move. Senate Bill 174 is going to get a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee coming up on Wednesday. This is a measure that would allow students, faculty, and guests to own, possess, carry, transport, or store a firearm on areas of the University of Alaska campus where not prohibited by law. Legislation would limit the Board of Regents' ability to regulate the possession and carry of firearms on campus at the University of Alaska. And again, the Senate Judiciary Committee getting ready to hear this bill, Senate Bill 174. Tomorrow, you've got campus carry legislation in Georgia that is also advancing. Governor Nathan Deal telling reporters that he doesn't think this is going to be an issue, campus carry passing. He said, you know, we heard a lot of the same complaints that we're hearing about campus carry now a couple of years ago when we passed a concealed carry reform measure. We heard all kinds of arguments. That we heard all the hype, he said, that we're now hearing about campus carry. All the predictions of tragedies. And he said they didn't come to pass. He said, so therefore, to use those kinds of arguments with the campus carry discussion, I think, lacks validity. House Bill 859, the campus carry legislation in Georgia, has passed the House. It is over on the Senate side now. And, you know, again, Governor Deal is right. We do hear that exact same arguments against campus carry that you hear against concealed carry. With, I think, maybe one exception. When it comes to campus carry, there is also the argument that college students are too drunk. They're too irresponsible. They're always messed up. There's no way that that these students should be walking around carrying concealed firearms. You do hear that argument that I think is sort of specific to the campus carry debate. the problem for the people making that argument is it's still not a good argument. Because who we're talking about are people who are concealed carry holders. So they're already lawfully and legally carrying a firearm off campus. And there's not an issue with these individuals being dangerous or irresponsible, drunkenly carrying their firearm around in an alcoholic haze. It doesn't happen. Because, again, we're talking about people who are far more law-abiding than the general population. So the argument that, well, when it comes to, you know, college campuses, oh, we just can't trust these concealed carry holders. Why not? What is it about setting foot on a college campus that turns that individual into someone completely different than who they are when they're off campus? And by the way, there are a lot more bars and liquor stores off campus, I would think, than on campus. So again, if that was going to manifest itself as a real problem among concealed carry holders, probably would have seen it in the state of Georgia by now, right? Again, it is it's an attempt to come up with an argument against campus carry that ultimately relies on denigrating the college students and faculty members who might possibly get their concealed carry license, or those who already have their concealed carry license. As far as a winning argument goes, I got to say, I don't see it. I don't see it being a very effective argument to say that, well, these students are just too irresponsible. They can't be trusted. These faculty members as well, too irresponsible, can't be trusted. But it doesn't mean they won't continue trying to make the argument. All right, coming up at the top of Hour 3, we have our Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcor Defense, our Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, and so much more. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this. So tell me about the tour that you have. This is launching in March.
Yeah, so every year we go from March to July. This year will be the same as that. We'll start out in Florida down at my home headquarters down there in St. Augustine, and we'll end in Bellingham, Washington. So I'll go up the East Coast through the Mid-Atlantic up into New England, cross the Midwest, the Plains, the Mountains, and then end up in the Pacific Northwest. I'll personally do about 30 stops with the tour vehicle, put on about 30 different classes, probably hit about 21 states, and then we'll have 9 other instructors. We may actually add a 10th other instructor this year that'll be doing classes. We'll have a total of 70 events under the Personal Defense Network training tour between March and July. And people can learn more about that at personaldefensenetwork.com under the training tab.
That is amazing. All right. If folks are looking at this and they're thinking, I want to bring this to my neighborhood next year. How do you select the cities that you go to?
You know, honestly, it's one of the big missions of the Personal Events Network training tour is when I'm in that vehicle, you know, you think about it. If I had to get on a plane, if I had to pack everything up, if I had to fly to the middle of a small town in one of the plain states, you know, the quote-unquote flyover states, if I had to go to Nebraska to do a course for 3 people, nobody's making any money. It's almost impossible to do. The range isn't going to win. The people, you know, they're going to get the training. They're going to get the win. But as a business model, it doesn't work. But when I get in that truck and I commit to 4 months on the road, I can drive through those small towns and build what we call training communities. So we just get people that reach out to us. They find me on Facebook. They reach out to Personal Defense Network. They find me at icetraining.us. You know, I answer all my own social media, Personal Defense Network. We've got a whole staff that answers all the inquiries and all the customer questions. When somebody says, hey, we'd like to host a class, we do our best to either myself or one of the other instructors to accommodate that request. You know, we try to fit it into the schedule. We make it make sense for everybody. And even if only 3 or 4 or 5 guys show up to that first class, we know that next year it's going to be 8 or 10. And next year that same range or that same training facility might host 3 or 5 other instructors from around the community, not just Personal Defense Network contributors, but everybody that's got something good to offer in the personal defense, the self-defense, home defense, the protection side of the industry. Everybody's looking for places to train. So, you know, reach out. If you have that classroom or you have that range, if you have maybe that small gun shop you thought, well, I could never get one of the Personal Defense Network guys to come out there, you'd be surprised. Reach out to us. Let us know. We'll try to work it out into the schedule.
How has your audience changed over the years? years, Rob, the folks who are calling you and signing up for these courses, has that group broadened over the past few years, or is it still basically the same type of folks you've been seeing all along?
No, if you look at my company, if you look at ICE Training, you know, before the advent of the personal defense network era, which really started in the mid-2000s, what we were doing at the Valhalla Training Center, what I was doing was probably about 80% armed professionals. It was law enforcement, military, you know, some really high-end military guys, high-end law enforcement. We were reaching people who already had experience, and we were sort of starting to sharpen that point, right? Now, over 80% of our business is relatively new shooters. It's people that have joined the NRA, it's people that have subscribed to Personal Defense Network, it's people that watched our shows on the Outdoor Channel and said, you know what, I take this seriously. I want to seriously get prepared to defend myself and my family in a worst-case scenario, and really that's what we're gearing towards. So instead of the next class that we come up with being, you know, the most advanced tactical whatever class for the high-speed operator overseas, the most recent classes we've come out with are really designed for what I call the base of the pyramid. The person who's in their 30s, in their 40s, hasn't really been a gun person, is new to the community, and their primary interest is personal defense. And that's really what Personal Defense Network is all about. That's what our communications is really reaching out to, is educating people that this doesn't have to be a lifestyle. You know, for those of us here at SHOT Show, this is our life. This is our passion. This is our commitment. Maybe we're enthusiasts. Maybe we're hobbyists with guns. Maybe we're recreational shooters. We're seeing a lot more people who aren't gun lifestyle people. Mm-hmm. They're just people interested in safety and interested in personal defense and interested in self-improvement.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, we have the hero of the day, sponsored by Adcore Defense. Our deal of the day, good guy of the day, plus Brian Lilly of the Rebel and the Blaze, Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media. Join us on the program in just a little bit as well. On Twitter, I made a brief appearance on Twitter earlier today, and someone was telling me, provided a link to the story out of a GQ. I'd actually already seen the story, but I'm glad that folks are talking about it. So the GQ new gun control study shows how effective. I'm sorry, massive new study shows how effective gun control can be. Is the headline by Jack Moore. He says that there's this new study published by Epidemiologic Reviews looking at gun laws around the world and gun violence stats both before and after those gun laws were enacted. The results, Moore says, well, while the academics are quick to say that the study doesn't conclusively prove that gun control reduces gun-related homicides, it does show that there is a trend whereby an increase in restrictions on firearm purchase and ownership leads to a decrease in gun deaths. So, Moore says, even though the evidence might not prove that gun control reduces deaths, the evidence does strongly suggest that. Here's how Vox characterizes the findings. We get a Voxplanation. Rather, countries passed big packages of gun laws which overhauled the nation's firearm code fairly broadly, which all tended to share similar features. According to lead author Julian Santayea Tenorio, these firearm packages generally included, quote, banning weapons that are actually very powerful. It's not a legal definition, by the way. It's just a phraseology there. Like, quote, automatic weapons. Quote, they all implemented background checks. Quote, they all required permits and licenses for purchasing guns. Vox says South Africa's Comprehensive Firearm Control Act, passed in 2000, contained all of these measures. And one study found that firearm homicides in five major South African cities decreased by 13.6% per year for the next 5 years. Oh, right after they passed the Gun Control Act in 2000. Now, here's something that Vox doesn't explain or mention. What was going on with the firearm rates in those five cities before the law was passed? Because I took a look at some crime statistics for South Africa. And what I found is that the homicide rate started dropping in South Africa about 1996, 4 years before these measures went into effect. Continued decline in 1997 to 98, a slight uptick in 1999, and then back down again in 2000, 2001. Here's the other thing, though. Over the last couple of years in South Africa, violent crime, including homicides, have started going back up again. Now, one would think if you're going to write a study and you're going to make that conclusion that, well, this strongly suggests that gun control works, you might also include the data that shows at some point the crime rate starts to go up again. So what's your conclusion then, that these massive gun control laws have a temporary effect on the violent crime rates in these countries, but over time, perhaps, criminals learn to disregard these laws? Because the crime rate and the homicide rate started going up again. And by the way, even when it dropped in South Africa, violent crime did not drop anywhere near as low as it is here in the United States, for example. Looking at crime stats in South Africa for 2012-2013, and they don't measure it calendar year in South Africa, which is part of the problem. It's fiscal year. It's basically April 1st to March 31st. So we're about a month away from the new crime stats starting in South Africa. But you go back to 2012-2013, and they reported homicides were going up. By the way, they continued to go up. They went up again last year in 2015. Attempted murders went up considerably. Robberies soared in South Africa. And the homicide rate in South Africa, far higher than it is in the United States. As a matter of fact, higher than it is than the global average. In 2013, the global average for homicides all around the world, 6.9 homicides per 100,000. In South Africa, in 2013, the homicide rate was 31.3 per 100,000. Again, the global homicide rate, 6.9 per 100,000. South Africa, 31 per 100,000. In the United States, you know what the homicide rate was in 2013? 4.5 per 100,000. Mm-hmm. More than two homicides per 100,000 below the global average. Now, this is something that you don't ever hear discussed, is it? Instead, what you hear is, well, the United States is the most violent country in the developed world. Well, how do you constitute the developed world? How do you decide whether or not a country is a part of the developed world or the developing world, or maybe the declining world? Maybe they're not developing at all. Maybe they're just going downhill. The United States per capita has either the most firearms ownership or the second most firearms ownership in the world. And yet, we do not have the most violent crime in the world, or the second most violent crime in the world, or anywhere close to the most violent crime in the world. Again, our homicide rate is below the global average, considerably below the global average. And 15 years, now going on to 16 years, of South Africa having these really restrictive gun control laws, they may have seen a dip in crime, a dip again that was already occurring before these laws went into play. But we've also now seen an increase in violent crime, which, if you're trying to make the case again that these gun control laws, you know, work, one wouldn't expect to see that happen. Right? 15 years after these gun control laws put in place, you wouldn't expect to have a country where the homicide rate is over 30 per 100,000, where attempted murders went up 10% over a year, where sexual offenses are on their way up. Street public robberies on their way up. 60,262 street robberies in South Africa. House robberies on the way up. Business robberies increasing. Vehicle hijackings increasing. You would not expect to see all of those numbers going up if restrictive gun control laws really reduced violent crime, would you? So, yes, there is the new study out. Take a look at homicide rates in five self-selected countries that the authors took a look at. Said, all right, well, we're going to look at these five countries, see what happened. We're not going to look at other countries that instituted restrictive gun control laws. We're not going to look at all of the violent crime rates. We're going to look at one number. We're going to look at a handful of countries, and we'll tell you what the results are. You know, it's interesting. When we were in Harrisburg at the Great American Outdoor Show, there were several outfitters actually from South Africa who were there, and we were talking about South Africa. And, you know, these folks said right up front, yeah, South Africa's always been pretty dangerous. The crime rate has always been really bad, particularly in the urban areas and cities. They said it got a little bit better back in the mid-90s. And again, not one of them said, well, after they passed the gun control laws, that's when it started getting better. Said, no, going back to the mid-90s, it started getting better. But starting a few years ago, things started to get worse again. And it wasn't because, again, the gun laws got relaxed. I don't know that they could tell you why the crime started increasing again. But I got the sense that a lot of it was maybe those intangible reasons that are so hard to determine. But, you know, almost that sense of because criminals think that they can get away with it. Because the clearance rates aren't as high, because the system seems overwhelmed, and the fear of punishment and prosecution is not what it was. And so the inhibitions of some criminals may be diminished. But either way, the reports of the vast success of gun control laws in South Africa appear to be incredibly overrated. All right, let's get to our hero of the day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. Comes from Arizona, Yuma, Arizona. Channel 3 in Tucson, KTVK, reporting a Yuma resident shot and killed an intruder in self-defense last Thursday night at the Med Park Apartments, according to Sergeant Lori Franklin of the Yuma Police Department. 48-year-old Thomas Salido forced entry to an apartment after banging on the door. Channel 3 reports a physical altercation with the resident ensued. The person told Salido to leave the apartment, and Salido responded with a verbal threat and advanced inside once again. The resident shot Salido, who later died from his wounds. Investigation is ongoing, but again, at this point, Sergeant Lori Franklin of the Yuma Police Department says this appears to be a case of self-defense. We'll keep our eyes on that story and give you any more information as it becomes available. Now, our deal of the day comes from Raleigh, North Carolina. Channel 11 on the story breaking yesterday in Raleigh. It was around noon. An officer tried to serve a warrant on a felony drug charge. The suspect took off running, was shot by a police officer there in Raleigh, A gun was found nearby. The suspect's mom says there's no way that her son would have had a gun. This was a scene where you had members of the community coming out, protesting police shortly after the shooting happened. And the investigation still continues. We don't know yet what all of these circumstances were before the death of this 24-year-old there in Raleigh, North Carolina. Akil Dinkins was the young man's name, 24 years of age. But Channel 11 reports that this suspect had a lengthy criminal record with more than a dozen arrests dating back 5 years. Dinkins charged, arrested and charged with, among other things, Channel 11 says, possession with intent to sell and deliver cocaine, carrying a concealed firearm without a license, and assault on a female. Now, again, this is a partial listing of the charges that he was facing. 12 arrests over a period of 5 years, and we don't know, I'm sorry, more than 12 arrests over a period of 5 years. But one thing that Channel 11 doesn't say is what the outcome of those cases actually was. We know that he was arrested. We know that he was charged and several of arrested again more than a dozen times. Don't know how many formal charges he faced, at least one, two, three charges. But we don't know the disposition of these cases. And I imagine that as the investigation into the death of Akil Dinkins continues, we will likely learn more about what happened in these cases. You know, most 24-year-olds can get to the age of 24 without having more than a dozen arrests to their name. But how many of these cases actually went to trial? How many of these cases were plea bargained down? How many of these cases were the charges just ultimately dismissed? Where the arrest was made, and maybe no formal charges were ever filed. How many cases actually did we see charges filed and then the case was dropped before it went to court? Case was null prost. The prosecutor reserved the right to pick up the case at some point in the future, but wasn't going to actively pursue it now. Again, we don't know. But what we do know is that a young man with a lengthy criminal history killed by police in Raleigh, North Carolina. Again, police say that a gun was found near him. Mom says that was not the case, that her son would not have been carrying a firearm. He did apparently face a charge of carrying a concealed firearm at some point in the past. But I want to know more about how somebody gets to the ripe old age of 24 with an arrest record like this. And I want to know what is the actual sentencing for Akil Dinkins look like. We'll try to find out more information, but he is our deal of the day today. And our good guy of the day from the Orange County Register in California. The story of an officer in Westminster, California, who seems to be doing a lot of community outreach. Mike Gradilla, he's 26. He works there at the Westminster Police Department. He found himself in the Orange County Register because of a kind of a simple little story. Taden Nguyen, he's 3, just started going to preschool, and he's kind of bummed about it, apparently. So his uncle, Joe Rinala, who lives in Huntington Beach, California, called the Westminster Police Department, local police department, and said, look, my nephew really loves cops, and he's kind of bummed out about going to preschool. So if anybody is in the area, if anybody has any time, spend a little time with this young man, could you? And Officer Gradilla did. He stopped by the house. Joe Rinaldo had no idea. I mean, he said, I had no idea that they did that. He said, Tayden watches police on YouTube. He gets excited when he hears a siren. He wants to know if it's a fire, an ambulance, or a police siren. So Police Sergeant Cliff Williams there in Westminster, California, sent Officer Gordillo over. Westminster Police Spokesman Sergeant Eddie Escueda says that Officer Gordillo is passionate about establishing positive relationships with the community, doesn't look for recognition. Sergeant Escueda said, Mike is a giver. He'd give you the shirt off his back. He quietly helps the homeless. This is not a publicity stunt, Sergeant said. Mike is the real deal. So Mike Gordillo shows up to cheer up this young man. And as it turns out, Mike Gordillo says, I was there to brighten his day, but he brightened my day. Tayden Nguyen had on a little police uniform when Officer Gordillo got there. Gave him a high five. Officer Gordillo gave Tayden a tour of the police car. Posted some pictures to the department's website. 60,000 likes as of yesterday. And Officer Mike Gordillo, who protects and serves the community on the job, when he's not working for the Westminster Police Department, he mentors a high school football and track team. He is also a basketball coach at the Boys and Girls Club there in Westminster. And he says that he hopes that he can be a mentor to a three-year-old Tayden Nguyen as well. He says that we can always talk about the day that we went viral. So Mike Gordillo there in Westminster, California, going above and beyond, protecting and certainly serving the community. We thank you, sir, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, when we come back here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company, Brian Lilly from the Rebel and the Blaze on the surprising trouble that Quebec's long gun registry is suddenly finding itself in. This was supposed to be a real popular measure, an easy measure to pass in Quebec. And now, when lawmakers are actually trying to do it, they're finding that resistance is growing. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Ruth Ann Sprague with NRA Foundation. Ruth Ann, tell folks, what is NRA Foundation? What do you guys do?
Well, the NRA Foundation is the 501c3 arm of the NRA. So we are there for charitable donations. We're involved in educational pursuits. But we are the part of the NRA. We can go out and raise money as a nonprofit, and a lot of that is done through friends of NRA, and then we can support the shooting sports or historical firearms, museums, things like that.
So you're here to support shooting sports and firearms museums and other things like that. And give us an idea of some of the groups that NRA Foundation supports.
Well, we support the NRA National Firearms Museum, but Boy Scout troops, a lot of youth groups, about 60% of our funding does go towards youth groups. We have supported historical firearms enactors, range improvements for nonprofit ranges, but those are the things that we can support.
So it's NRA Foundation. You raise your money a lot. You said friends of NRA and other ways. And then how can folks who are listening to this go, gosh, how can I get some of this money? What's the best way for them to get involved to find out? How do you guys disperse this?
Well, the best thing to do is to look at our website, nrafoundation.org, and the general public can see how they can contribute. Qualified groups can see how they can apply for a grant. There's a lot of great information at that website.
Great. And in about 20 seconds we have left, why is it important that NRA do this kind of work?
Well, hey, this is the shooting sports. This is the future. What we're doing is raising money now and then giving it to, especially to youth programs, so our youth can learn firearm safety, they can learn about hunters education, and we can carry the hunting tradition and shooting sports into the future.
Talk with a friend, Benny Spies, again from Gunna with Benny Spies. Hopefully the audience has watched the program. If not,
if you haven't, you should.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a fun show. And that's what I like about it, is that it's not your It's not, you know, 2 minutes in.
No, we do a lot.
We've got to, you know, when's the dead deer coming? As you say, it really is personality driven.
Yep.
You are, you're quite the personality.
There's a lot of moving parts. We do a lot of different things. We drive around that old Winnebago, the Toaster, 73, or the old Chevelle, 65. It's a secret weapon. You know, we got the new boat, the Aluma Craft, the Willie Nelson. You know, there's a lot of moving parts, and we have a lot of fun.
Why is the boat called the Willie Nelson?
Because my old man, when I was a kid, would take me fishing or whatever, wherever we were going hunting or fishing. He had one tape, and it was stuck into the cassette tape in the pickup, and it was always On the Road Again. It's the only song that I ever, my first favorite song, so I dedicated the boat to Willie Nelson.
And that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Does the Chevelle have a name?
The Chevelle's a secret weapon, yeah.
It's just a secret weapon.
That's not running right now. Nothing of mine runs.
No?
No, the boat does. But nothing of mine.
Do you actually like tow the toaster?
Yeah,
the toaster would
be better off on fire.
But it's iconic.
It is iconic.
You can't. You'll never be able to get rid of that thing.
I hope I don't have to. So I hope I can keep doing this. And where I go, the toaster goes.
Right.
That's the plan.
So you're saying that you don't want to show up here 1 year and be like, instead of the toaster, you've got the bread oven, which is like the 80-foot long concert tour bus.
Well, that means we've upgraded a little bit.
Yeah.
But I still want it to be in the 70s. You know, we need the shag carpet. You know, we need it. The smelling like the 70s. There's more mice living in that thing right now. That I have a trap line actually set up in there, and I put a big jar of peanut butter at the end of it. I say, if you guys can make it through that, Godspeed.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Looking over at the National Harbor in Maryland, that is where CPAC is going to be taking place later in the week at the Gaylord National Harbor Convention Center. We'll be broadcasting there Thursday and Friday. And make sure that you tune in on Thursday of this week. We're going to be signing on at about 12:45 Eastern Time so that we can bring you live coverage of Wayne LaPierre's address at CPAC. That is scheduled for around 1 o'clock Eastern, but we want to make sure that you don't miss a minute of it. So we'll be signing on early on Thursday on NRAnews.com, beginning at 12:45 Eastern. I want to welcome to the program right now from the Rebel and the Blaze, our friend, our neighbor to the north, Mr. Brian Lilly. Brian, how you doing, sir?
I'm jealous how I'm doing. Very jealous.
Yeah.
I don't get to go to CPAC this year.
As the government restricted your movement there in Canada, you and Ezra are ticking off some powerful people up there.
Well, we are, but not quite. It's what's ended up happening is that we've got our own political convention. One of the provincial parties here, the Ontario Conservative Party, is holding their convention. It happens to be in Ottawa, where I live, so I've been assigned to go to that.
Okay. Well, I you'll be missed. You will be missed. But it is, it's good to know that there are still, multi-parties in Canada, that, all is not lost yet. So, and I'm sure that, frankly, that's probably going to be a barn burner of a convention there in Ottawa, given that, you don't have a conservative government in charge of the federal government in Canada anymore.
No, we don't. We don't. And we'll see how that goes. Although this year is going to be a great year at CPAC with all the presidential hopefuls, although maybe fewer on Friday than there are today. We'll see at the end of the night with the results. But anyways, I know that you wanted to call up about the what's going on with Quebec and the gun registry. And good news is I've talked to there's a conservative party that started in Quebec that's actually in favor of gun owners. And I was able to meet him on the weekend and talk to him about this very issue.
This this really is fascinating to me, Brian, because, when the federal long gun registry was scrapped by the conservative government a few years ago, the province of Quebec said, well, we want to have our own long gun registry. And so they sued to get access to the federal long gun registry data for Quebec. Court told them, no, you're not entitled to that. If you want to have your own database, go and start your own database. And so now that they're actually trying to start doing this, they are meeting with, I think it's fair to say, a heck of a lot more opposition than what maybe most folks anticipated.
Yeah, Quebec is an interesting place. I mean, this is an area that I know I live next to it right now. I used to live in it. This is an area where if you listen to the elites, it's an urbane place, and they all just point to Montreal. You get outside of Montreal, And it's much more about hunting, fishing, trapping. Everyone's got a skidoo. Everyone's got an ATV and a boat and a shotgun. Yeah, I might compare it to New York. I'm literally sitting right now at a 5-minute walk across the bridge from Quebec. But I'm about an hour's drive north of upstate New York in the North Country, Adirondacks and all of that. You know, Manhattan, people would be appalled at hunting. They'd be appalled at target shooting. But I drive an hour south of where I am. I mean, the biggest mall when I cross over New York has 2 sporting goods stores as the anchors. You know, instead of like a Macy's and a Nordstrom's, I forget. One's a Dick's, and I forget what the other one is. But they compete for people that enjoy the outdoors life. You would love it there. But, you know, Quebec and New York State are not dissimilar in that once you get outside of the major urban center, it's a very different place. But their politics has not reflected that, and the politics has tended to lean toward whatever Montreal wants. And so very left-wing, very much against guns, and now there's pushback, some of it driven by guys with the National Firearms Association, one guy in particular named Claude Colgan, who's an interesting cat because this is a man that lost his sister in the Montreal massacre that led to the original gun registry. And he came out a few years ago and said, my family have been hunters and shooters a long time. Stop using my sister's image, the image of my dead sister, to push for gun control. Our family doesn't support it.
Wow. You know, but it's fantastic to see individuals like that speaking up, but there has to be more than one individual, right? I mean, that has to be a message that resonates with people in Quebec. And apparently it is resonating.
So what's happened is that there was not there were 2 gun organizations active in Canada. Tony Bernardo, you know, with the Canadian Shooting Sports Association. Then there was National Firearms Association. Neither one of them had a very strong Quebec presence. And a couple of years ago, there was a decision to try and get a Quebec presence. Now, the reason for that, Quebec's mostly French-speaking. These organizations were primarily English-speaking. So a lot of Francophones were excluded. They didn't have an organization to turn to. Well, now they're starting to organize. Now they're starting to push back, and that's why you've got some politicians going, hold on, wait a minute. You guys have figured out that you can get together and pressure me? So there's divisions within the Parti Québécois, the left-wing separatist party. There's some divisions within the Liberals, which is a left-of-center governing party currently. And the head of the Conservative Party in Quebec, which is fairly new, they don't have any seats, but they're trying. He told me on the weekend he's going to every gun show he can find.
Interesting. That's where he's looking for supporters for the Conservative Party.
You know, in addition to looking for people that are into free markets and lower taxes and individual liberty, yeah, he's going to the gun guys and saying, if you want a voice, I will be your voice. Quebec's provincial legislature is one of the weirdest places I've ever covered. I've never seen a legislative body that has so many unanimous votes. And they're always, you know, exactly what the left-wing activists want. So they're unanimous against guns. They're unanimous for higher taxes. And they will literally say, we passed this unanimously. Nobody will object. And that has included calls for greater gun control. Now they're starting to feel the pushback, and I think that there might actually be a free vote on instituting a gun registry. Will it likely pass? Probably. But this is a hopeful sign. I have to say, Cam, very hopeful sign.
Absolutely. And as you say, a free vote, that's when you can actually vote your conscience as opposed to voting the way the party tells you to vote.
Yeah, I mean, you can call it a whip vote, you can call it a party line vote. There's different terms depending on your legislature, but you know, every legislature at times will, you know, the party will say, you got to vote with us. This one, they might say, okay, you can go your own way. We'll let you.
Well, we'll be following along closely, and let us know when a vote is scheduled, if a vote is scheduled, will you?
We'll do, and you don't have too much fun at CPAC without me.
We will do our best. We'll do our best. And give our best to the great conservatives up there in Ottawa, will you?
Will do. Thanks a lot.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Brian Lilly from the Rebel and the Blaze. Join us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. I am looking forward to CBEC. I think our coverage is going to be fantastic Thursday and Friday. We're going to be able to talk to a lot of great folks, friends of the program, as well as hopefully some new faces. We'll always have the opportunity to check in with and meet some new folks there. I will say this, coming from, we were just in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the Great American Outdoors Show. Very different event than CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. But I'm already thinking that CPAC could benefit from all of the food trucks that were there at the Great American Outdoors Show. It was a lot. You know, have you noticed that, Cameron, when you get there at CPAC, and this is one of those things, like, automatically you shift to, like, one meal a day because there's no way for you to actually get any food there at the hotel.
Yeah, and as much as the Gaylord is, it's one of the, you know, it's a really beautiful addition to this area, and we're lucky here when we're in this studio. It's our view out the window here on our offices. But the only drawback is it's so big, you really can't go anywhere because the show itself is so big. And to actually to get into the show takes forever. And then once you're there, the last thing you want to do is leave the premises. And the people at the Gaylord are geniuses at that, you know, because I've been to a few of them. They do this all these places. You're like, it's like a cruise ship. They have everything you need. Why go anywhere else? But yeah, some food trucks would be nice, but it would take I think people would miss entire speeches walking there, waiting in the line, and then walking back. So I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I don't think so either. But, you're right. And you look like we, eat a big breakfast, grab dinner after the show is over, and we can get through just fine. It's not that there aren't restaurants there. There are. It's just that, you know, when we're working and folks like Cameron said, you know, you want to catch the speakers, you want to catch the panel events, a lot of times you're grabbing that energy bar. You're walking by, seeing if anybody has, like, any croissants laying out on a table somewhere, and you're just scooping it up. Not that I would do that, but I've seen I haven't seen anybody do that. But I wouldn't be surprised if they did. All right, when we come back here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Stephen Kreuzer. I guess that's more of a Bloomberg move, isn't it? Grabbing food off of other people's plate and eating it. So maybe that's not something you'd see at CPAC. Stephen Kreuzer of PJ Media will join us on the program right after a quick timeout. So stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, right after this. Here at the Great American Outdoor Show at the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Teresa Vail is with us. How are you, Teresa?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am excellent. Love the shirt, by the way.
Thank you. I feel like I'm all NRA'd out with the coat and the shirt.
Right?
Got to represent.
Are you having a good time here at the Great American
Outdoor
Show?
This is actually my first year here. I'm used to SHOT Show and the NRA convention. This is a new ball game. There are tons of people here. I didn't expect that.
Yeah, and this is huge, too.
Yeah,
it's massive.
The complex is amazing.
And it's really interesting because, you know, you mentioned SHOT Show and the NRA annual meeting, and these are both, you know, events that you'll get anywhere from 50 to 80,000 mm-hmm. attendees. Mm-hmm. We're looking at somewhere around 200,000
people. That's what
people
they said.
Here.
I know. Walking through the halls of this place is nuts. It is chaos.
And for 9 days, you know, we get these crowds, which really shows you, I think, just how popular the outdoor sports and the world of the outdoors really, truly is in this country.
I was going to touch on that. That's what I love about these conventions, about these trade shows. This one especially, because it brings together like-minded individuals. Everybody here, you know that they're supporters of the NRA, probably, or they love hunting. They love the outdoors. It's like-minded. You're with people who think and feel that the way you do.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit. For those who haven't had a chance to really get to know you, what's your background? How did you get into the world of hunting and shooting?
My dad started me hunting when I was 10. Bow hunting is what I really prefer to do. I didn't get into that until about 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago.
And all of a sudden you you love it.
I'm drawn to it because of the intimacy. Instead of being 150 yards or 200 yards away from an animal, you need to be, 30, 40 yards, perhaps even closer. So I like that up and close personal feel to it. And I think it gives you that much more respect for the animal. But there's still a time and place for guns. I prefer guns for protection, for personal defense. I carry. I love going to the range.
Want to use a compound bow for personal defense? That's not your preferred choice?
I don't think I'd be as quick on it. Have you seen the TV show Arrow?
I have.
Okay, so that's what comes to mind.
And, right.
You know, he's a badass with a bow, but...
We can't all be superheroes.
But we can't all be superheroes as much as I would like to be, and I try to be.
Right. Yeah. And so tell me, because you've had the opportunity to go and do some incredible hunts and visit some incredible places. The people that you talk to and that you're involved with in these hunts, is that as important to you as the game that you're actually going after?
I think hunting, there are two aspects to it. It can be very, very personal, and then it can be very, very social. The dichotomy, I think, is what makes it so fascinating. I like the social aspect because we can go out pheasant hunting, and while you're pheasant hunting, you get to joke around and talk, and you don't have to be hush-hush. It's very social and lively. But then that other side of it is you can be in the tree stand alone by yourself for hours and just have that solitude and peacefulness. And that's what I prefer. I'm a lone wolf. It's what I prefer. But the dichotomy of it is fascinating, and I do love both aspects.
You know, and in this modern connected world, too, I think it's so important to have those moments where you are disconnected. And it's you and the tree stand and nature, and, you know, there's that focus, but there's also that ability to just sort of let all of that other stuff go, right?
I couldn't agree more. And that's my peaceful place. So everybody knows the Serenity tattoo that I have. And I got that because of my feelings for the woods. The woods gave that peacefulness to me. You know, Dad started taking me out when I was 10. There are no cell phones. You can bring a book, sure, but you're still disconnected from the internet, from the age of social media, which I hate. There's a time and place for it, but I do hate it.
Yeah.
And you're away from that, and you get to focus on what's really important.
Absolutely. So tell me about what you have going on now with all of your, again, it is an interconnected world, and we get a chance to watch you on TV.
Yes.
We get a chance to watch you on NRANews.com.
Yeah.
I can't even keep up with everything you're doing.
I can't even keep up with everything I'm doing. We just wrapped up filming season 5 of NRA All Access. I hosted season 5. We're now moving on to season 6 of NRA All Access, and that's on Outdoor Channel Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time.
Okay.
And we're just coming up with new ideas for season 6, moving into season 6. Season 5 was incredible. We went to Italy and hunted pheasants there and toured the Franchi shotgun factory and saw the intense history behind it. So I'm looking forward to season 6 and what it brings.
All aboard!
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Has any news network taken this song as their campaign theme for election 2016 yet? If not, there you go. Steven Kruiser of PJ Media joins us on the program right now. Steven, happy birthday to you, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Glad that you're spending a few minutes with us. And it's so I guess this really is a Super Tuesday for you, isn't it?
It's Super Kruiser Day, as I said on Twitter. That's what it's like. I was originally happy that the leap year was going to make my my birthday skip a Monday this year, and then I realized it was landing on Super Tuesday, and I'm like,
Would it have been,
okay with it,
you know, I mean, I suppose it could have been better, you know, right? Or it could have been worse if you were born on February 29th. You would have been...
I missed that by a year. If I'd been born a year earlier...
It would be like 5. You wouldn't be old enough to vote yet.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So any birthday plans for today?
My daughter, because she's a senior in high school, so it's the last time she's going to be living at home with Pops before she goes off to college. We're going to go have a nice dinner at our favorite Polish restaurant.
Nice. Well,
yeah.
Congratulations, and good for you. I imagine it'll be a little bittersweet there with your daughter being a senior.
I am not going to be a good empty nester, just so you guys know later. I'm prepping for it. I already got a cat and joined a wine club, okay? If I start doing paint by numbers, you'll know I'm too far gone.
Just remember, it's better to hoard the wine than it is to hoard cats, okay?
Yes.
Just We'll have Kurt come over and check on you every now and then. Just make sure he's up to like 18 cats. We got to do something.
Yeah. That'll work.
So, obviously, you know, with today being Super Tuesday, even though you might want to avoid the political news, I don't think it's possible for you to do so. Although out in California, when is the California primary?
usually later in the spring. Or I mean, it's always completely over by the time it gets to us. Because really, this is only a one-party voting state in the primary anyway. The Republican thing doesn't matter that much. It's like it's always way over. So, and I'm not sure exactly when it is this year, but we're never. By the time it rolls around to us, it's only the people who are the most hardcore voters who actually go vote.
You know, this year, I mean, maybe on the Democratic side, it'll be over. I have no idea what things will look like on the Republican side. I suppose it's you know, likely maybe that Donald Trump is a clear front runner. But at this point, Stephen, I have really honestly given up trying to predict how the rest of this election season will go. And I am much more interested in just kind of following along and, you know, not getting so caught up and wrapped up in some of the silly stories that are out there, I think, to distract us as voters.
Well, yeah, and there's like, you know, the media, especially now that they've got so much to latch onto, but it's, you know, it's, I've adopted more of a, you know, I'm not a huge Trump fan, but we'll get that out there, but I've adopted more of a, you know, let's strap in and try to enjoy this ride for as much as we can here, because it really is, especially for Republicans, a very interesting time, because this is so unlike any kind of primary season we've had in forever, because it's not just the next guy in line with the most money, you know, mm-hmm. That's been our MO for years. And I don't even know if I'll be a Republican by November. There's a chance I might not be, but it really is an interesting time. And if you kind of can detach yourself just a little bit, it's a lot more fun to watch, even though, you know, the whole country may burn. But my attitude is, if the ship is burning and going down, let's get up to the Lido deck and enjoy as many cocktails as we can while that's happening.
You know, look, I hope we are not watching the burning down, BERN or otherwise, of the nation. But, you know, this is, as you say, I mean, this is unlike any, not just is this unlike any other Republican primary that we've seen, in our lifetime. I think this is unlike any other election that we've seen, in our lifetime. I think the mainstream media is not as interested in covering the split between the Sanders supporters and the Clinton voters on the Democratic side. But, you know, I'll be honest with you, Stephen, I've heard from a lot of people. I've seen a lot of people quoted as well who feel just as strongly, you know, that they would never vote for Hillary Clinton or they would never vote for Bernie Sanders. They're really the deep divide and the deep divisions. It's not just on the right side of the aisle right now.
Oh, no. I mean, the only place where they were dissimilar was in the number of candidates originally running, but these are almost mirror image primaries right now because they're dealing with overwhelming discontent in their own electorate, each party, that they didn't see coming. The party elites in both parties, the pundits, nobody saw it coming on either side. And it really is, that's the thing that's interesting to me, is because, you know, the other thing we haven't seen much in the last 20 or 30 years is a super energized electorate. Now, we'll have to wait and see if a lot of this youth fervor translates into votes in November. I'm suspecting that if Bernie doesn't get the Democratic nomination, that most of those kids will just stay home because that's what they usually do. But it really is the seething anger with no more business as usual is pretty much the same on both sides of the party for a variety of different reasons.
Yeah, well, you know, and you're right. I mean, it's a variety of different reasons, and it's certainly manifesting itself in different ways. But, you know, your daughter's a senior in high school. I've got a son who's a sophomore in high school. I've got a couple of kids who are older, and they're already out on their own. I've got a couple of kids who are younger. And, you know, I was talking about this the other day. My kids who are in their 20s, I've got a daughter who's in her late 20s. And, you know, undeniably, when you're starting out your career in your 20s, you know, it's a struggle, right? You're going to be working a lot of hours and you're not going to be making a lot of money. But there, at least for me in my 20s, I could chart a career path. I could say, okay, if I work hard, there are going to be opportunities that will open up here, here, and here. And it just seems like, Stephen, doors keep shutting. The path, the opportunities keep getting narrower and narrower for an entire generation. And, you know, I think that these are real concerns that people are feeling. Now, I don't think the answer is, we'll make college free, because I don't think that you can actually do that. I think that it's still going to cost someone somewhere, to pay for college. But I understand, and I think that there really are genuine concerns here. And I'm sure that those concerns are felt by Americans, frankly, you know, all along the political spectrum.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. That's one of the great lies of the Obama era, where when the economy got slightly better, they started touting it as if, you know, happy days are here again. You know, if it was, but they were back in the FDR days coming out of the Depression, and it hasn't been that way at all. It's been a sluggish, awful economy still. The jobs numbers are always a smoke and mirror thing that aren't, that really don't reflect reality. And people, young people, are finding out exactly what you said, that despite this story they've been told about the magic wand that Obama waved over the economy and it got better, really isn't true. And that's manifesting itself. That's where the Bernie stuff comes from with them.
Absolutely. And again, you know, if you've got somebody who's saying, well, you shouldn't have to pay for all this stuff, that's it's a pretty seductive message. And I can see why there are some Americans who are seduced again by that message. You know, look, I guess maybe the real question is how many, as you say, how many Americans end up staying home, end up, you know, throwing up their hands in disgust on election day, and how many of them do get energized, whether it is to, you know, save the republic or to reshape the republic, but they get out there and they vote in November.
Well, I think that the old stay home protest vote was always more of a Republican thing than a Democrat thing, because the Democrats generally just flip into hive mind mode when it's time for the general election. And that's not me just being dismissive. That's the truth. I mean, they almost always rally around whomever they nominate, and you don't get a lot of them just sitting home. The one demographic that never shows up the way anybody says it's going to show up is that mythical unicorn youth vote they're always talking about. But I think that this year we may see some of that stay home protest vote on the Democrat side too. I think that there are a lot of Republicans right now who are so angry that their protest votes are going to manifest themselves in other ways. I think they're going to go to the polls, but I know people that are talking write-ins. I know people that are talking, okay, I'll vote this party, I'll vote that party, but I think they're going to hit the polls. But I don't know that as many people are going to stay home because everybody's just so seething.
Yeah, and no, that's a really good word to describe it. And, you know, look, I don't even know. Frankly, I don't even know how many independent candidates we might have at this point, right? I mean, the headline from ABC News today, Bloomberg looks a lot less likely to get in. But as the talk of Bloomberg getting into the race fades, now we're seeing more talk of, is Mitt Romney perhaps going to hop in? So, Stephen, this could be one of those crazy years where if we'll know, I guess, over the next couple of weeks. But if you've got $1 billion burning a hole in your pocket and you're not going to miss it, and you've ever harbored fantasies or dreams of being president of the United States, why would you not take the plunge this year?
We may not even have free elections in 2020, so you might as well give it a shot right now.
Well, Kanye's got 2020 locked up. I mean, he's done. It's Kanye 2020. I'm already predicting that. But, you know, although who knows what his financial situation is going to be like 4 years from now. He might not have the money to finance his campaign, right?
No, yeah, I think once he gets on the lithium, he'll calm down on that too. That kid needs some medication. I heard a story about his $53 million in debt. That's how much it cost him to launch this new streaming service and to pay for the album. He's not really $53 million in debt. That's how much he sunk into this, and he hasn't gotten that back yet. So he's got plenty of money for you Kanye people that are holding out hope out there.
I didn't even realize that Kanye had a streaming service. Is this
very few people do
different? different than why do we need that? I mean, we have iHeartRadio and we have Spotify, and why do we need Kanye's?
He's got a streaming service that's only streaming his new album. It's even better than it's so Kanye. It's like, it's quintessentially Kanye. It's like, okay, I've got this streaming service. You can only get my new album there, and it's the only album on the service. So go.
That's kind of up there with Apple putting the new U2 album, the last U2 album, on everybody's iTunes, right?
Yep.
It's amazing that we are still a celebrity-obsessed culture, Stephen, given the quality of our celebrities these days. You know, like, I expect more bang for my buck, frankly.
Well, I've got a theory about that. I think one of the things, you know, back in the day, before social media, the publicists were able to carefully manage the personae of their various celebrities and clients. And now with social media, you know, it gets all out there. And I think that it's like, It's the same reason I think that golfers love to watch golf, because you can see the really rich professionals make the same bad shot that you do. And now with the kind of celebrities we've got, you can see them make the awful life choices, and you feel like you've just moved onto a little moral high ground, even though they're worth $50 million. But, you know, I think that's why we like watching that. It makes us feel just a little better about ourselves in a very sick, sad way.
You know, I think you're onto something with that. You know, it sort of, look, my mentality, generally speaking, about celebrities, and I said this on the program yesterday, there's always a possibility that some celebrity is going to be really wise and I'll actually learn something from them. But the default position that I hold towards celebritydom is you're my court jester. You're there to entertain me, right? So
yeah.
Juggle or tell a joke or do something entertaining, entertainer, because that's what you're there for. And I'll be pleasantly surprised if you're smart and rational and I can actually learn something from you. But that's not why you exist in my world. You exist as an entertainer to entertain.
And the entertainers that understand that are the best entertainers. Like, I've always, like, I sit there and I'll say something and everybody in the room will laugh. I'll have no idea why it's funny, but I'll write it down, because if the audience thought it was funny, that's really all that matters. I'm not there to entertain myself.
There you go. All right, so we got like 60 seconds left. Are we ever going to see you on a college campus on stage again?
We're working on more live performances after my daughter goes to school. I'm just sticking here until next fall so I can spend time with her.
All right.
And then we're putting together all that stuff right now.
Okay. Let's hope that you're still allowed on a college campus next year.
Yeah. So I'll be at a re-education camp. I'll be one of the first ones there if that happens.
Stephen Kruger, listen, we got to run, but thank you so much for coming on the program today. Enjoy your birthday. Enjoy dinner with your daughter, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay. Take care.
All right, man. You too. Stephen Kruger with us from PJ Media here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Now, we only have a few seconds left on this program, but the good news is that tomorrow is only Wednesday, so we'll be back with much more throughout the week, including live coverage from CPAC on Thursday and Friday. Again, don't forget the live Thursday afternoon, 12:45 start time on NRANews.com, so we can bring you coverage of Wayne LaPierre's address at CPAC. Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review coming up on tomorrow's program, breaking down the Super Tuesday results and looking ahead. Julie Gunlock, Frank Miniter of Forbes, and more. We'll see you tomorrow on another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosland.